This is the Quality News Network. The Dow Jones was up nearly 100 points at one point in trading today. We'll have the closing numbers from Wall Street coming up in our business block. The federal judge in the Lewis Scooter Libby trial has denied his motion to stay out of prison while he appeals the case. He ruled Libby must go to prison within the next 6 weeks. However, the date and facility has not been chosen yet. Libby was sentenced to 2.5 years for lying and obstructing the inquiry in the CIA leak case. In the latest NBC News Wall Street Journal poll, President Bush's job approval rating has reached a new low of 29%. That's down 6 points from April's poll. 66% say they disapprove of how President Bush is doing his job. In the same poll, the congressional job approval rating is 23%. Also in the poll, only 19% responded that the United States is headed in the right direction. 68% of those surveyed say the country is on the wrong track. President Bush has made a concession to help move along the stalled immigration bill. He has agreed to funding for federal border security up front to gain the support of conservatives who have disapproved of the legislation. In the Gaza Strip, Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas has declared a state of emergency as Hamas fighters have nearly gained control over the entire area. He also dismantled the coalition government. Hamas declared that Gaza is now under Islamic rule and thus on its way to becoming an Islamic state. In Beirut today, a funeral procession took place for the anti-Syrian legislator who was killed yesterday by a car bomb. Altogether, 10 people died in the blast, including his grown son and 2 security guards. Tens of thousands of mourners took part. South of Baghdad today, 3 Sunni mosques were torched in apparent retaliation for yesterday's bombing of the minarets of the Golden Mosque, a sacred Shiite shrine in Samarra. Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki sent in extra security forces to Samarra to help keep the peace. Top congressional leaders sent President Bush a letter yesterday that bluntly declared that the Iraq troop surge policy has failed. The Russian computers that control key aspects of the International Space Station, including water and oxygen supplies, crashed yesterday, but are now partly working again. And an internet group says that 1 in 5 people worldwide has a high-speed internet connection.
To help offset global warming, each of us can help ease pollution of our environment in a variety of ways. At home, use less energy by turning off lights and switching to fluorescent bulbs. Weather-strip doors and windows, run the dishwasher only when full. Turn your water heater down to 120 degrees Fahrenheit, recycle household trash. U.S. households produce 21% of the country's global warming pollution, and just these few minor adjustments can make a big difference. On the road, slow down for better gas mileage, drive less, and keep your vehicle tuned up and tires properly inflated. For more information on what you can do to help reverse the effects of global warming, contact the Environmental Defense Fund online at fightglobalwarming.com. This Environmental Minute has been provided in the public service by the Quality News Network.
Colgate is warning that fake toothpaste sold at discount stores in the U.S. could contain a toxic chemical which is commonly found in antifreeze and solvents. So far, the toothpaste has been found in New York, Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Maryland. Kellogg's has agreed to make the foods it markets to children healthier in response to a threatened lawsuit by parents and advocacy groups concerned about childhood obesity. The world's largest retailer, Walmart, reports that theft, also called shrinkage, is increasing in its stores. The retailer says customers and employees are responsible for the increase, which is expected to amount to more than $3 billion this year. The parent company of the Wall Street Journal, Dow Jones, announced the weekday price of the paper will go up next month to $1.50 from the current $1 at the newsstand, but the subscription price will not change. Dallas-based Hyperion plans to build an $8 billion refinery somewhere in the Midwest. It would be the first new oil refinery built in the United States since 1976. Light sweet crude is trading at $67.65 a barrel on the New York Mercantile Exchange. And at the close of Wall Street today, the Dow Jones was up 71 points, ending the day at 13,553. The NASDAQ was up 17 and the S&P 500 up 7. There's more at our website, qualitynewsnetwork.com. I'm Allie Dramov.
Head On is brought to you every night by the West Virginia District Council of Carpenters and Millwrights. Union Carpenters and Millwrights, they're building the American dream. Free speech isn't free if you don't use it. So call Bob now at 1-877-4-HEAD-ON. That's 1-877-443-2366. Now, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! All right, we begin this Thursday evening edition of Head On. I'm Bob Kincaid, by the way, except no substitutes. With a little bit of natural sound, natural sound, perhaps. It is a lovely evening here in the hills and hollers of West by God, Virginia. And it's so not, you know, air conditioning, schmear conditioning. It's nice outside. There's a huge thunderstorm blowing through. Huge, I tell you, huge. Agnes doesn't like thunderstorms. She would rather be under a bed somewhere. The lightning struck not too far away a little bit ago, and that little hairs on her arm just stood straight up. And it's like she has some prescient sixth sense where she knows the lightning before it's going to strike, and she'll flinch, and then the lightning happens. It's kind of creepy, really, when you get right down to it. Yeah, my wife Powder, if you ever saw the movie. She's not quite that pale yet, but working on it. It was so nice. I decided to open the color weather window here at the fabulous Head On Radio Network studios. So that crackly popping sound is actually the gentle sound of a warm spring rain falling on the green and luscious hills of West Virginia. And the thunder you hear I'm doing that for a reason, because folks who don't live in the hills... I don't know. Thunder's special here. It's got a quality that I never noticed growing up in Alabama. A reverberant, resonant, basso profundo kind of quality that really has to be experienced. And now that I've opened the window, it won't thunder again. That's just the way stuff works. But still, you know, we're trying. A couple of observations right off the bat. Most notably, did you hear, and I've heard this a couple of times today, and I've seen it in a few places on the series of tubes, the internets, I love a con artist, this press release by the Colgate-Palmolive Company. You remember our little discussion about Chinese poison toothpaste from a couple of weeks ago? Well, you know, as usual... God, I feel so bad. I'm not trying to pull a Rush Limbaugh and say that, you know, that I'm anything special, but we do seem to have a knack here for getting ahead of the curve. And really all that involves is paying attention and being cognizant of things that sort of likely will find their way onto the public consciousness. Apparently, the Colgate-Palmolive Company has issued a press release regarding a Food and Drug Administration recall of toothpaste. Yeah, toothpaste. And the FDA has recalled a number of small economy or trial size tubes of Colgate toothpaste that have been sold in like New Jersey, Pennsylvania, New York, Maryland, because it's Chinese toothpaste that's made with diethylene glycol instead of glycerin, because diethylene glycol is cheaper. And as far as the Chinese manufacturers are concerned, and the American investors who own the firms that are, you know, by the Chinese investors, you know, what's a little kid dropping dead in Trenton compared to the massive profit margin that can be realized by switching out diethylene glycol in place of glycerin. Right? So the FDA has recalled these particular small tubes of toothpaste. Colgate-Palmolive responded by issuing a press release from the halls of their PR flacks, saying, yes, the FDA is absolutely correct. Be alert, be aware, be on the lookout for that fake Colgate toothpaste. It's not real Colgate toothpaste. We really don't have all our toothpaste manufactured in the People's Republic of China. We make it right here in Mom's kitchen. Oh, we hope you haven't bought any of that fake Colgate toothpaste. Really? I couldn't make this stuff up if I tried. I'm not that creative. It's just astonishing. Oh, be on the lookout for the fake Colgate toothpaste. That fake Colgate toothpaste might kill you, but it's not real Colgate toothpaste. You can't sue us. Yeah. But, you know, that's the America where you live. Welcome to a country of 300 million souls that can't manufacture... Oh, that was a nice one. Welcome to a country of 300 million souls that can't manufacture its own dentifrice. Ooh, there's a $10 word, Bob. Dentifrice? I know you are impressed, Agnes. But seriously, isn't that a little bit embarrassing? We can't make toothpaste anymore. We can't make shirts. We can't make shoes. We can't make tires. We can't make TVs. We can't make stereos. We can't make toothpaste. Go to the local, you know, dollar joint stores, and you'll find that your breakfast cereal is made in Mexico. Yay, NAFTA! I just love NAFTA. Don't you love NAFTA? I love knowing that I'm eating breakfast cereal from a country that has next to no environmental protection laws. Mm-mm. Yeah, that's right. That's right, Peter. We can't make toothpaste, but we can make meth. Well, that's just the entrepreneurial spirit of the American capitalist. As dear leader has frequently reminded us, the small businessman is the heart and soul of the American economy. And the small business, you know, that includes your bathtub meth lab, sure. So that's, you know, 300 million strong, this nation. We can't make steel. We can't really make cars. Because even if you buy one that says, buy one for an American car manufacturer, odds are it was assembled in Canada or Mexico or Sierra Leone or Kuala Lumpur or God knows where. If you listened the other night to our conversation with Lieutenant Eric Schein, the same part, you'll note that we can't even ship our own goods from overseas anymore. We are fast approaching a sort of critical mass where the American people can do nothing but consume. We are fast approaching a point in time when the perfect analogy for the American people is going to be the thousands upon millions of cattle on the industrial feedlots standing in caca up to their fetlocks, who can do nothing but consume and excrete and die. Oh, boy, we're off to an optimistic look at America tonight on Head On. Oh, yeah, get the razor blades out. Damn. Let's take a break, and then we'll come back and go straight to the phone calls. Oh, wait. A couple of things before we hit the break. First of all, in the second hour this evening, coming up at about 5 minutes past the hour, 5 minutes past seven here on the East Coast Eastern Time Zone, we're going to be joined by Eric S. Peterson. Mr. Peterson has recently edited a lovely little tome called Light and Liberty, Reflections on the Pursuit of Happiness, and the book is entirely the words of none other than Thomas Jefferson. And it is a beautiful book. It is a beautiful book. His publicist, Bhagirathi Savage, noted in her correspondence with me that Mr. Peterson's sole purpose in presenting this book is the promotion of the vision of Jefferson in order to inspire our country. There are no royalties associated with it, reflecting Random House's policy on books developed from words that are already in the public domain. Mr. Peterson is reinvesting the modest fee paid by Random House for the book in an effort to spread Thomas Jefferson's light and liberty. And in a time when things do look rather bleak, I have found this book to be a genuine inspiration. And of course, if you want to purchase the book, and I encourage you to, you can get it through the website at headonradionetwork.com. Segments in the book such as faith, happiness, aspiration, fitness, cheerfulness, gratitude, sincerity, not thirsting for gain. Well, you know, I think we could probably Xerox that one and send it to the, I don't know, how about the CEO of Snake Farm Insurance or All Snake Insurance or Kaiser Permanente? What do you say we do that? Okay. And a little kind thank you. I was reading Bart Kopp's page today, and someone wrote into Bart Kopp telling him that he has a wonderful, and he does, I've tried it, a wonderful recipe for fried chicken. It's just yummy. But it turns out the person writing also said, as soon as I get more money, I'm sending it your way, talking about Bart, and will begin downloading your radio show on my MP3 player along with my daily dose of Mike Malloy and Bob Kincaid. And it's signed Celeste, and Celeste just happens to be the daughter of the late, great Clarence Gatemouth Brown. If you are not familiar with Clarence Gatemouth Brown and you love music, you should be aware and familiar, well familiar, with Clarence Gatemouth Brown. Texas swing, multi-didact in a variety, guitars, mandolins. Oh yeah, everything from big band swing to down home blues. Whoa, this is a little bit of this is Duke Ellington's "Take the A Train" as performed by Clarence Gatemouth Brown. Dig it. We'll be back with your phone calls, 877-443-2366, 877, the numeral 4, head on, or on your own nickel, 304-658-5453. Let the thunder roll. Let Gatemouth play on. We'll be back. This is America's liberal voice. This is The Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid.
But those jeans have got to go.
Yeah, I know. Grab me a pair next time you go to the store, would you?
No.
Huh?
I'm not going there anymore. I can't stand it.
What do you mean?
It's just awful, honey. The only smile in that building is that big yellow face. Everybody else looks miserable. And I can't find anything there that's made in our country. That bothers me.
Well, nobody makes clothes in America anymore.
Au contraire, mi amigo. There's a ton of American-made clothing at No Sweat.
Well, where's this No Sweat store? Out at the mall?
No, silly. I found them at headonradionetwork.com. There's a link there. I already ordered some great workout gear, and I also got you some new jeans. They'll be here in a couple of days. Surprise.
Headonradionetwork.com?
Uh-huh. Just click on the No Sweat banner. You're right there. Helps union workers and helps support support America's other liberal network. Cool, huh?
I knew listening to the horn was a good idea.
Whose idea?
Your idea, dear. All the good ones are.
Union made? No sweat. Great prices? No sweat. Great looks? No sweat. No sweat at HeadOnRadioNetwork.com. Click the banner. Do the right thing.
This is the Head On Radio Network. The Horn.
This is Billy Shears. Do you remember the Kellogg's Rice Krispies jingle?
Snap, what a happy sound. Snap is the happiest sound I've found. You may clap, rap, clap, clap, but snap makes the world go round. Snap, crackle, pop, Rice Krispies.
Well, this week on Foxed Up, you will be surprised to know just who composed that jingle and the band who recorded it. So join us this Friday at 11 a.m. Eastern with John Fox on Foxed Up. Right here on the Head On Radio Network, The Horn. This is Billy Shears, and hey, thanks for lending an ear.
Hey, kids. There are some questions about what's this new gay conversation radio show coming in June on the Head On Radio Network. Well, the details are safely locked away in my closet, located on a dirt road in the rural South. So the next time you're traveling on an interstate highway, staring out into the red state abyss, just smile and think to yourself, honey, we're everywhere.
Baby, I got your number. Oh, and I know that you got mine.
Hi, I'm Peter Godbold, and welcome to Strictly Confidential. The show premieres June the 18th at 9 p.m. Eastern, exclusively on the Head On Radio Network.
You can call me, baby. You can call me anytime. You got to call me.
This is The Horn, the Head On Radio Network. Hey, who's that guy?
Hello, little girl. Don't you remember me?
Oh, yeah.
Hello, little girl. Don't you remember me?
I think this just turned into a music program. Don't you dare turn that down, Agnes. Mm-hmm. Love it.
Well, I'm doing all right.
All right, all right. If you don't pull it down, Agnes, I won't do a show tonight. You know, I don't know. Somewhere along the way, I sense a music show in the Horn's future. I don't know how we're going to make it happen, but there's too many people involved with this network who have entirely too much musical wisdom, musical knowledge, musical genius, musical talent to just leave it lay there. I told you we'd get some thunder around here, didn't I? Seriously. Would you guys, tune in for a music show? Maybe something, I don't know, maybe something pre-recorded on the weekends. Just a place to hang out for 3 hours on a, late on a Saturday night and listen to some great tunes picked out by some great minds. Would you do that? Because I can't imagine, that'd be fun, wouldn't it? I was just thumbing through, and we'll go right to the phones in a second. I was just thumbing through Light and Liberty, as edited by Eric Peterson. I ran across this. this is writing that's maybe, you know, a little more than 200 years old. And, you know, you'd like to mail it off to Alberto Gonzalez and see if it's quaint yet. These are Jefferson's words, not Mr. Peterson's. When I first entered on the stage of public life, I came to a resolution never to engage while in public office in any kind of enterprise for the improvement of my fortune, nor to wear any other character than that
of a farmer. I have never departed from it in a single instance. Thus, I have thought myself richer in contentment than I should have been with any increase of fortune. I'm guessing Dick Cheney's never read those words. I'm guessing that if Thomas Jefferson, like unto some sort of miraculous Jesus, were to reappear in the clouds in glory and revisit the state of the republic which he birthed, I'm guessing Dick Cheney would have him killed, talking anti-capitalist heresy like that. Nor to wear any other character than that of a farmer. charming, isn't it? The idea of being devoted to a country, being devoted to a polity, the idea of being devoted to anything except the relentless pursuit of money, money, money. Oh, Dick, Dick, how you pervert such a beautiful dream. So I'm looking forward to that conversation here shortly. We're taking some lightning hits here. Let's go to... We'll go to the phones and find out who... Well, like I said, we're taking some lightning licks through here, and I think some stuff just kind of had to be reset. Let's find out who's going here. Okie dokie. Agnes, why don't you see if there's a dial tone going there at all? Okay, there you go. Okie dokie, see if there's a dial tone going there. Seriously, I'm very serious.
That's what I'm doing.
Okay, well, pick it up and...
I'm
talking, you're checking. Okay, we've been whacked.
I'm working on it.
We're going to reset the phone system. Brother, I hate it when this kind of stuff happens. You know, it's kind of hard to do a show without a phone system, and so we had to have it on, but I hope Appalachian Power or Verizon hasn't whacked us again. This is so very frustrating. But I think you will enjoy the conversation with Eric Peterson, assuming the phones work, that comes around later in the evening. No man ever had less desire of entering into public offices than myself. In truth, I wish for neither honors nor offices. I am happier at home than I can be elsewhere. I have no ambition to govern men, no passion which would lead me to delight to ride in a storm. Whenever a man has cast a longing eye on offices, a rottenness begins. Listen to this. Whenever a man has cast a longing eye on offices, a rottenness begins in his conduct. I love to see honest and honorable men at the helm, men who will not bend their politics to their purses, nor pursue measures by which they may profit, and then profit by their measures. I have the consolation of having added nothing to my private fortune during my private service and of retiring with hands as clean as they are empty. Now, counter that, or consider in opposition to that, the polling data that we just got today. We have dial tones. I'm so happy.
The God of Thunder and Rock and Roll still presides. Thank you, Bob, for all your griping. It works.
Of course it works. Thank you. And someone's even calling. But consider the polling numbers that are out right now. The polling numbers that suggest that George Bush's approval ratings are around 29% and Congress's are at
23%.
You think Nancy Pelosi or Harry Reid's taking a look at that at all?
I can tell you how they can get those congressional poll numbers up by standing up to the guy whose numbers are 29%. How hard is it to get a hold of that idea? I mean, when the American people think you suck that much, there's really nowhere to go but up. You can't get much below the margin of error at 23%. It was 23%, wasn't it? Yeah, I think it was. Okay, let's go to our good buddy Andrew. Hey, Andrew, welcome to the program.
Hey, what's up, Bob?
How you been?
I've been all right. I've been around, man. I'm here. Still surviving, you know.
Hanging on, bailing water.
Yeah, yeah. But, yeah, the music deal sounds kind of cool. I like that.
Yeah, wouldn't that be fun?
Yeah.
Now all I got to do is convince the people who need to do it to do it.
Okay. Well, if you need a scout or something, I'll dig up something.
Okay, so, sounds good.
And, you know, put a contribution. You know, I guess if you take it like if it's like whoever's going to be listening, if, you know, they send in their request, then that should be good enough.
You know, I think this could be a level of it could really enhance listener participation.
Yes.
So, you know, especially the nature of music being what it is today. God, we could be all over the board, Andrew. You know,
yeah.
We could, you know, blues, rock and roll, country, roots, you know, alternative. Yeah. There's nowhere a show like that couldn't go.
Yeah, everything. Just play everything. And if it has a message to it, all the better. So, you know, that's what it is. Usually music does have a message. But, I'm kind of sick about the whole thing about the surge, and this is what I really called for. But the surge, I called for that too, but I really, this was sticking in my craw since yesterday. But the surge.
Mm-hmm. The escalation.
I want to talk about redeploying troops, okay? I was listening to Jeff Arias on Nova M.
Right.
Last night, and a caller called in and said maybe we should pull some troops out or, you know, put them out on the horizon. I was like, no, take the troops and send them to Kurdistan. Send them up to northern Iraq, northern Iraq, and have them guard the oil, because that's where the oil is. And that is going to be the only saving grace for the Iraqi people. Now, while you're doing that, the troops didn't leave Iraq, okay? So once you're doing that, then you can get together a worldwide oil commission for Iraq, for the situation in Iraq, similar to, like, the Nuremberg trials. Okay,
mm-hmm.
And go over that whole oil law with a fine-tooth comb, and if it's okay or needs adjustments, that commission would make those adjustments, and then that will be, with the blessing of the Iraqi parliament, that would be, you know, as law, will disburse the monies to the Iraqi people, not just checks in hands coming in the mailbox, but back into their infrastructure, education,
roads, water, sewage, power grid.
Yes.
Well, you know, that's the problem, though, Andrew.
Been talking about that.
The deal as it exists, what is it? It's like we get health care around here. It's an 80-20 split. Exxon and Shell, Royal Dutch, Shell and BP and so forth, they get 80% of the oil revenues, and they dribble back 20% to the Iraqi people whose oil it was in the first place.
Yeah, and 19% of that's going to get gobbled up by the government. So.
Sure.
You know, because the government's going to be, you got to have a shady government to go along with something like that. That's like highway robbery. That's like just holding somebody up with a gun, you know. So
yeah, and of course, there's oil in the, you know, that's the problem here. The Kurds have oil, the Shia South has oil, and the Sunni middle has sand.
Yep.
And so there's a lot of problems inherent in all of this. I think the people who have put out ideas for a multinational peacekeeping force, and I would add to that, Andrew, a multinational Arabic-speaking peacekeeping force, have a good idea, because you really can't get a handle on making the country secure until you can tell what Ahmed on the corner is saying. You may think that he's saying, yay, American soldier, when he's actually saying, you're going to die, sucker.
Exactly. And that goes to the whole thing of them, like, firing these interpreters and everything, you know.
Right, exactly.
Language. Because they, the Bush administration, they don't want to know what they're saying. They're just saying, hey, you're nothing but like a pawn I have to take out, know, that's it.
Right.
So they don't give a damn what they're saying, because they know what they're saying is that they want them to leave, and if they leave, then there's going to be an initial squabble amongst, you know, the Iraqi people, because it's already going on now, but that's going to subside, because they're not dummies over there. They're not dumb savages in Iraq. Those people were, you know, they were equivalent of us back when Saddam, even though they had a dictator, but somewhat like we got now on a watered-down level right now, somebody who's trying to be one, trying to be a Saddam over here, but they were just as advanced as we were.
Sure. They had pharmaceutical industries. They had petroleum industries. They had manufacturing concerns. They had a fully functioning state.
And why shouldn't they have? They got oil, so they should be, you know. I mean, they have our fuel supply for right now.
See, the only problem is, I think part of the reason for that 80-20 split, Andrew, has to do with not just the profit motive of the oil companies, which is monumental, but it also has to do with making sure that Iraq can't get enough money out of its oil to start getting all uppity.
Exactly.
Because, you know, if they've got 50% of their oil revenues or 60%, why they might do more than turn the lights and the water on.
It's an economic muzzle.
Yeah.
One way to get the people down. Period.
And
people down. If they don't get no money, they can't get up. They can't ride. They can't do nothing. And that's why they're putting hell on us over here, because it's the same effect. But, you know, they're trying to put an economic muzzle on us over here. People can't go to protest because they're afraid they're going to lose their job. And if they lose their job, they know there's not one out there readily available. You know, so it's a way of silencing the people. Period.
Plus, you know, we don't want them going all communist or anything and starting to send, you know, several $1,000 checks to every single living Iraqi, every month.
No, but make them know. You create jobs, and then they start rebuilding their country, then they'll have jobs to do.
And then they'll get all uppity.
But initially, you're going to have to give them something, because we didn't tore up everything.
Yeah.
I'm not saying, like, long-term, sending out checks, but you got to give them something in the beginning so they can, you know.
They have to be able to get on their feet. They have to be able to defend themselves.
Yeah, you're going to have a big infusion of money from this Jump Street.
That's exactly right.
All revenues.
It's worth remembering that that particular part of the world was once a part. It was one of the first areas. The Medes conquered Persia, and then Persia went after everybody. And one of the first things they went after was that ripe plum sitting there between the rivers that was Babylon.
Yep.
And you know, these people are going to have to be able to defend themselves against an Iranian onslaught, or against, you know, I would like for them to have a viable country, because it's a response to basic human needs to have some sort of non-chaotic existence.
Yeah. But, you know, people don't, you know, I don't know if people are understanding. They understand that everything in Iraq is messed up right now. They understand they're getting gouged at the pump. They understand that it's costing them a lot of money to feed their families and to keep the lights on and everything else. But something's holding us back, and I think it's that very fact that everything's so expensive and everybody's so worried with, you know, part of the reason besides the mainstream media, which we talk about all the time, and everything we say about it usually is true, that they don't report the news. But people are concerned with, you know, how they're going to make ends meet, and that's a way of squashing dissent too, you know. But
it most assuredly is.
And they set us up for it. With all the home equity loans and everything, that was a total setup. That was a setup. I blame, you know, yeah, you can blame the individual, too, but you can blame the banking system, how they set that up. They said, we'll get them all strapped down, you know, we'll boom the housing market up, and everybody will start taking out loans on their existing mortgages. People have been in their houses for 20 years. Now they're strapped with some crap loans, you know, and that's a way of keeping people down and keeping people from speaking out.
Well, I don't know who to blame more, them or us, for falling into the trap.
Yeah, well, I think it's more them, and especially the media's fault, because they didn't report. They're not reporting the truth.
You ever wonder how much...
Come on, you can't work with garbage. I mean, we don't have town criers anymore to stand out in the town square and just start yelling off, you know, the news of the day. People have been geared to the TV since it came out, and so, you know, they always knew that was going to be a hypnotizing device, so...
Yeah, but I can't help wondering, Andrew, being someone who formerly watched a good bit of cable news, I'm down to watching almost no TV whatsoever anymore.
Me too, pretty much. I'll
revert come college football season because that's my guilty pleasure.
Yeah. Well, it is what it is.
But did you ever watch, I mean, did you ever pay attention if you were watching cable news or something like that, whether it's MSNBC, CNN, Fox, headline news, whatever, how many Ditech commercials were running?
Yeah, dude.
With that smarmy dude, you know, who's...
You don't even see him now, hardly.
But boy, I tell you what, they made their money, didn't they?
Yeah, they did. Yeah,
and they must have paid a fortune for those ads.
Oh, yeah, they did, but they made probably 20 times as much on them.
Sure.
30, 40 times. Whatever.
So, you know, when you talk about the media having a hand in this, you're spot on. Because they, you know, they were more than happy to take Ditech's money to advertise this predatory lending.
Yeah.
And some of it's still out there.
Yeah, it's out there. Totally out there. Still out there. They're just repackaging it and making it even worse. Oh, God.
And
they're going to ask for a bailout, too. So, you know, we're going to have to bail them out. And,
sure.
Hey, whatever.
Exactly. Well, have yourself a wonderful evening, Andrew. It's always so very, very good to hear from you.
Yes, it was nice to talk to you too, Bob.
All right, you take
care. Hello, Agnes.
I love you.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye now. Tried to turn the microphone around so Agnes could say hello too. It sounds like the thunderstorms have passed, so maybe we have dodged a bullet. Oh, wow. Hail coming towards us? Lovely. Thank God we don't have the Mercedes C500 sitting in the yard. onward to Kevin calling from D.C. Hey, Kevin, welcome to the program.
How you doing, Mike? I mean, not Mike, Bob. I call you and Mike all the time.
We're both doing fine, Kevin.
Yeah. I want to, you know, about the conversation with the toothpaste and stuff.
Yeah.
The question I have, and why is it we should not be getting our drugs from Canada now?
Right, because if they come from Canada, we'll get poisoned.
Yeah, you know, it's like, I don't know, what is up with these people? And, you know, we're not making anything. Our army cannot even be mobilized without Chinese labor now. And that's the truth. The uniforms are made in China. Hell, the guns are made in China, too.
What?
Yeah. A lot of the M16s, parts of it, are made in China. They may be assembled here, but they're made in China now.
Dear God.
Yeah, so it's like, and in the meantime...
The federal government needs Ike Turner, too.
Yeah.
Sorry, I had to go back to that. I've been hanging on to that one for a couple of days now. It's become my new benchmark standard. Where in the play, you know, who needs, you know, who in this world needs Ike Turner?
Yeah, but I really don't understand. And I'm at the point now where I'm at the verge of thinking about leaving the country myself for a better quality of life. I really am.
That idea passes my mind every day, and it becomes extremely tempting.
Yeah.
I'd love to pack up all of this and go offshore, and put it on the internet and do what we're doing now. Unfortunately, I can't.
Yeah. You know, do what what's his name did in Australia. You know, he did it. And he seems pretty happy from what I
gather. You mean John Fox?
Yeah.
John wants to come home.
He does?
Oh, yeah.
Oh.
Australia is becoming such an ecological nightmare that it's gonna be really, really bad in about 10, 15 years, if not sooner.
Yeah, well, look at the government they have, you know.
Yeah, it's a little Ronald Reagan, George Bush wannabe government.
Yeah. You know, hopefully the Australian people will wise up, and Canada is heading the same way, you know, with this new clown up there.
Now, my perspective has changed, Kevin, ever since my conversation with Joe Bagent.
With who?
Joe Bagent, about 3 weeks ago. It was a Wednesday evening, and he bugged out for Belize for a while. Of course, he lives a very simple existence when he goes down there. I don't know if the infrastructure exists for us to fire this up and broadcast from Belize, but dang, it sure would be fun.
I am thinking about moving back to where my family's from, Jamaica. I've considered it heavily, and believe you me, I know the country almost inside and out, and the infrastructure is there. They have high-speed internet and everything, so...
Well, you know, the saddest thing out of all of this, Kevin, is that you and I are having this conversation.
Yeah.
We're both Americans, okay? We are, you know, with one degree or another of the so-called American birthright, and, you know, pull ourselves up from our bootstraps, and it's the American dream, and everybody who's got a chance, and all they got to do is work. And that's all been proven to be just an abject bunch of baloney.
Well, Reagan, you know, the past 20-some-odd years have made it that. And it's like I tell like these older people who are, you know, cashing out, and, you know, hopefully they plan their money really well, because, you know, I'm living in a generation, my generation, which is I guess Generation X,
mm-hmm.
but also how educated we are depending on inheritance from our parents.
Well, sure. You know, I saw a video today. I go through and I watch news videos during the day, Kevin.
Yeah.
And I saw one, I forget what particular locale it came from, but some smart-ass comedian on some cheesy morning shock jock show talked about going to this female news reporter's house and going through her panty drawer.
Yeah.
And said, you know, I got to tell you, there was nothing really exciting there.
Yeah.
So she gets back from vacation and goes after and decides to turn the tables, goes and visits the guy.
Yeah.
Who lives with his dad. He's 40 years old. He lives with his dad, and they show him, and he shows her and the camera crew into the bedroom, and it looks like the room of a 12-year-old.
Oh, yeah.
Just garbage laying all over the room. My generation, maybe yours, we have issues.
Yeah. Well, we have issues. The reason is because, you know, we've inherited a bad economy, which basically... you know, has screwed us out of the American dream, you know, except for the well-connected top 10-20%. We've been screwed out of our American dream, which was promised to the previous two generations.
Yeah, everything the generation that raised me had, I don't have, and it's almost impossible to have. You know, the old, well, like our good friend Wayne was talking about growing up in Pittsburgh, where you grow up, you finish high school, and you go to work in the mill, and you work there for 30 years.
Yeah.
Or 40 years.
At least you were paid in real dollars, too.
Yeah.
Don't forget, Nixon took us off the gold standard, which, you know, if you know anything about Economics 101, you know, a 1970 dollar, a dollar you earned in 1970 is worth $11 today.
That seems about right.
Okay. So, the guy who was getting paid $5,000 in 1970 could afford to live a lifestyle of someone who's making $60,000 today.
Says a lot, doesn't it?
We've been fooled into believing we're making more money than our parents. We haven't.
How can we stay fooled, though, Kevin? Because we go to the gas pump, we go to the grocery store.
A lot of this is just willful ignorance on the American people. It really is. You know, a lot of Americans, they rather watch, you know, Paris Hilton and Lifestyle, the rich and famous, and, you know, what's that idiot show on Fox with the singers?
Oh, American Idol?
Yeah, you know. And
okay, now we get the nasty email from Billy Shears. He loves American Idol.
Yeah, hey, you know, and not to mention this lotto fever mentality that we have, you know, where we can all get rich quick.
Yeah, well, you know, I joke about the lottery. I go out and I buy my Powerball number every Wednesday and Saturday, because that's my retirement plan.
Yeah, well, it's not mine, but, you know, if I win it, not to say I don't play, but if I win it, basically, I'm out of here. I'm casting in my ship, and like the smart rat that I am, I'm getting off of the sinking ship. But
while it's in the shallow water.
Yeah, exactly. Because I tell you, this country is... Bush has made it that this country is in such a wreck. It's going to take generations for it to recover. And look. look what he's done. He's bought all this land in South America. Why?
Because it's the happening place to be when the revolution comes.
Yeah, you know, Paraguay is a nice little country to hide out in.
Yeah, you got great next-door neighbors, the Moonies.
Yeah, so, hey.
And you've been business partners with them for, you know, your family's been hooked up with them ever since they got unhooked from the Nazis. So, you know, why not go? And there's Nazis in Paraguay. It's a Bush family paradise. Nazis, Moonies?
Yeah.
What's not to like?
Great big frontier, wide open spaces, maybe even oil.
Oh, Lord. Hey, Kevin, good to talk to you.
Okay, then.
Give us a yell back soon.
Okay, I will.
All right, bye now. And on to our good buddy David in Maine. Hey, David, welcome to the program.
Good evening, Bob.
How are you?
Yeah, I'm good. You know about the Clarence Gaymel Brown? You're talking to a fan as well.
Oh, cool.
I think he's amazing. There's something that people should check out. Ovation used to have this short film. I don't know if you've seen it, Bob, but it's Clarence, and he meets this girl playing a classical violin. Have you seen this short
No, film? I haven't.
It's an amazing film.
Well, he was a fiddle player, too.
Yeah.
Mandolin player.
And he could play classical. He could play all of that.
Yeah.
And he, if you read his interviews online, he is like a true version of what a Texan conservative is. He has a gun. He has a gun on his hip and all of that stuff.
Oh, he quit music and moved to New Mexico to become a deputy sheriff in the...
Right. That to me is an example of a what a conservative should be.
Well, you know, rugged individual. That's rugged individualism. It's also very quintessentially American. Pick up and go do something else. Learn how to do something new. Reinvent yourself. Be what you want to be.
Well, that's true. I look at conservatism though as the real definition of conservatism, to conserve.
Yeah.
But not this crap. Not the selling point. But anyways.
Well, you know, it's worth remembering, David. Conservatism here is not conservative. Just like as John Fox frequently points out on his program, the fascist little goons running the country in Australia, they call themselves the liberals. And they're every bit as right wing as anything George Bush would ever want to be. That's why they love hanging out together so much.
That's true. One of the things that I was going to mention also is that Tommy Chong was on MSNBC.
Loved it.
Have you seen it?
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
And then I saw the follow-up from the Colbert Report where he explains to Stephen Colbert just how he would administer punishment to Paris Hilton. Oh, God.
Yeah. The MSNBC didn't know that Tommy had spent 9 months for a bong.
They didn't know?
Oh, you didn't see that clip, did you?
I didn't see that part.
Oh, well...
I just saw him talking to Contessa.
Oh, it might have been Contessa. But what I'm saying, did they show the whole interview?
I guess I didn't see the whole thing.
She talks about it, and he's like, well, she goes, you weren't in jail, though. He goes, yeah, I was. I was in jail for 9 months. She's like, oh.
Really?
Yeah.
Do tell.
So, but that's not why I called. I called to talk about this 10-step plan for anti-war activists that's been posted on Information Clearinghouse.
Okay.
Step one, they say... we have to move beyond blaming Bush. The fact of U.S. empire is bigger than Bush. Hopefully by now all of us are more clear how the Democrats have been and are now involved in enabling the whole U.S. military empire building plan. It is about corporate domination, and he's just a front man for the big money. It's kind of like a common sense, the first one.
Okay, would you shoot me that link? I'd like to go over it in either this evening's program or tomorrow's.
Oh, no problem. And, you know, just put it up on your blog.
Yeah.
So. Yeah, I know you're probably running out.
No, you got a few minutes.
I got a few minutes. Yeah. Okay. Billy Shears, I have a message for Billy Shears about American Idol. I used to feel that way about music industry people, and then I started seeing something common, Bob. I started seeing a lot of people, singers and songwriters, not getting that job because someone put a pop icon now in place on the TV, and people say, he goes, well, that's not really happening, is it? Yeah, it's happening. A lot of people in the industry right now are out of jobs because they want to put these people front and center in the poster boys, and they say, well, who's to say that they would get a major label record deal or whatever? Well, the reality is, you have to look at it this way. for every pop icon that they put on from that damn show, you're losing about 10 artists per label.
How do you figure that?
Because you got the budget, you got the overhead, you got so much things that propel something like this. They
well,
know
what, the part, money what part does the centralization, you know, just like media has been centralized, you know, and all major media in this country is owned by four or five or six corporations, so too with music.
I know, I don't
Sony
think
people, owns everything.
I don't think people understand when you take a singer and a songwriter out of the equation and you put a self-contained unit, you may think it's ear candy, but what it's really doing, and it's not even about the quality of the music, it's about taking someone's job, damn it. That's what it's about. It's about taking lots of jobs off people's labels, because now you don't have to have that songwriter and his crew and his posse. You can hire the people from inside the label.
Wow.
And that's what's been happening, Bob. That's what's been happening. You know, I'm gonna play a song later on next week, and I'm not gonna give it away what it is, but I'm explaining to you this is what has happened with the songwriter, the session musician. You know, a lot of the session musicians that are out today, Bob, they're not in the studio anymore. They have a day job. They probably have enough pride to say, well, I'm on to the other path. I'm on to alternative means or alternative ways. But they're not going to tell you that they're at Walmart working security or something. And that's why I don't like, that's why I hate American Idol. I guess I can say hate, dislike, or whatever, because basically what it's done is it's taken all these labels, it's slaughtered so many positions, all of these musicians who were about to get a leg up, who were about to get started, Bob, just got tossed to the side. They said they were promised this, they were promised that, and that goes for like, and when you have somebody like that, then you have your whole team, and then everything just crumbles into the sea. That's why American Idol is toxic for this industry. It's slaughtering people left and right. Musicians who were making a good damn living, but now they're not, because you got to get that idol on there, on that label.
Boy, that's a different way. I was just looking at it from the pure hypnosis aspect.
I know, and that's the thing. We all look at it from that angle. I looked at it from that angle, and I'm not telling you people, don't think like me. Don't automatically assume that, but just check it for yourself. Look, just pull back and see what is happening to a company. You know what? You know what's good? Go to like velvetrope.com or someplace like that, and just go to a website with the deals with the industry, or talk to some of the producers, Moses Avalon. You know, there's some of the industry handbooks. But basically what's happened is all of this, it's the get-rich-get-quick type scheme that's hyper-accelerated now, and that's what Idol is doing to a lot of people and a lot of subdivisions. Everyone's getting cut left and right because they realize, oh my God, all I have to do is put this person on the TV and hey, there we go.
Well, David, thanks.
No problem, Bob.
Talk to you soon.
Later.
Bye now.
Bye.
That's significant food for thought. And bless his heart, I don't want Billy Shears out there feeling like he's been attacked, because he hasn't been.
American Idol's okay.
Agnes says American Idol's okay.
Leave Billy alone.
No, seriously, I'm concerned with media as heroin, and that's the biggest part of it for me. So I don't know. I simply don't know. So, you know, we'll explore this at greater length. I know the music industry is just upside down and screwed backwards by virtue of the fact that everything has been absorbed. We're down to two or three record labels, two or three companies, except for the indies. You know, the labels like... New West comes to mind. The smaller labels, but they're still distributed by Sony. Way back when Teddy Roosevelt came here, oh, he's a trust buster. Well, he didn't bust them well enough, because they're back.
with a vengeance. You're listening to the Head On Radio Network. You're listening to The Horn, America's liberal voice. I'm Bob Kincaid.
I heard you on the wireless back in 52, lying awake intently tuning in on you. If I was young, it didn't stop you coming through.
This is a quality news network. In the Gaza Strip, Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas has declared a state of emergency and dissolved the unity government. Hamas pushed out its Fatah rivals and has taken control of the area. Witnesses say after overrunning two enemy security command centers, Hamas fighters dragged rivals out of buildings and shot them execution style in the street. Hamas has declared the Gaza Strip is now under Islamic rule and will become an Islamic state. South of Baghdad, three Sunni mosques were torched in an apparent retaliation for yesterday's bombing of the minarets of a revered Shiite shrine, the Golden Mosque in Samarra. Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki sent in extra security forces to Samarra to try and secure the peace there. Iraqi sectarian violence has increased in the past 3 months. That's according to the mandatory quarterly report from the Pentagon to Congress. Top congressional leaders sent President Bush a letter yesterday that bluntly declared the Iraq troop surge policy has failed. The administration says it's too early to judge. The transfer of $25 million of frozen North Korean money begins today from Macau to Pyongyang. North Korea demanded the money be returned before any negotiations begin again aimed at nuclear disarmament. President Bush has made a concession to help move the stalled immigration bill along. He's agreed to funding for federal security, border security up front to gain the support of conservatives who've disapproved of the legislation. An opponent of the bill said he appreciated the funds to secure the border but did not want to tie immigration to it. In the latest NBC News Wall Street Journal poll, President Bush's job approval rating has reached a new low of 29%. 66% say they disapprove of how President Bush is doing his job. And a judge has ruled that former White House aide Louis Scooter Libby must go to prison while he appeals his conviction. Libby must report to prison within the next 6 weeks. The former chief of staff of Vice President Dick Cheney was sentenced to 2.5 years for lying during the investigation into the exposure of a CIA agent's identity. And there may be another extension of the current Atlantis space shuttle mission. There have been problems this week with the Russian computers controlling positioning of the International Space Station. You're listening to the Quality News Network, Science and Business News, next.
Most people would rather have a root canal than go to a dealer to buy a car. But you can turn dread into joy when you learn how to play the car buying game. Read the book, Right Car, Right Price, and you'll discover how the game is played and how you can win every time. Whether you're buying a car or a truck, new or used, Right Car, Right Price explains how to find and buy the vehicle best suited to your individual transportation needs. Auto Week called Right Car, Right Price the right stuff. So take the hassle out of car buying. Read Right Car, Right Price, and every time you get into your new car, you'll know you've got a great deal. Go online to RightCarRightPrice.com to order your copy today. It only takes an hour to read Right Car, Right Price, and it just costs $10. We even pay the postage. So go to RightCarRightPrice.com right now. It'll be one of the best decisions you ever make.
The TB patient who set off a public scare by taking several international flights recently will have surgery to remove part of his infected lung. Doctors say next month they'll take out a tennis ball-sized area of Andrew Speaker's lung tissue. It's infected with an extremely drug-resistant tuberculosis. And Kellogg's has agreed to make the foods it markets to children healthier. The world's largest cereal maker made the decision in response to a threatened lawsuit by parents and advocacy groups concerned about childhood obesity. Biodiesel company Energy Alternative Solutions has teamed up with fast food restaurants and grocery store chains to recycle grease. They're turning it into diesel fuel for vehicles. The fuel will be initially sold in Northern and Central California. For the seventh time in 2 years, Sprint Nextel will acquire an affiliate. The wireless company will pay $312.5 million to purchase Minnesota-based Northern PCS. Wholesale inflation went up in May as gas prices went up more than 10% in the month. And the Labor Department also reports the unemployment benefits claims were unchanged last week. Light sweet crude is trading at $66.92 a barrel. At the close of Wall Street, the Dow was up 71 points, the Nasdaq up 17, and the S&P was up 7. There's more at QualityNewsNetwork.com. I'm Laurel Krissen.
It's your second hour in the Liberal Sandbox, and you're head on with Bob Kincaid.
Six and a half minutes past the hour. It is the second hour. We've made it through the thunderstorm here. Great to still be with you. I'm Bob Kincaid. It's time for our conversation with the guest I described to you earlier, namely Eric Peterson. Mr. Peterson is a managing partner at Hawkins, Delafield, and Wood, a law firm in New York City. He is extremely well-educated and has, I suppose you would say, a calling or a hobby of studying the life and works of Thomas Jefferson. He's been at it since 1993. He is with us now. Mr. Peterson, welcome to Head On.
Thank you, Bob, for having me on your show.
It's a real pleasure, and I want to thank you for the work that is Light and Liberty. I have a feeling this book will be wherever I am working for a long time to come, because it's sort of like having Mr. Jefferson in the room with you.
Well, thank you for saying that. You know, I worked with his writings for many years. I had the opportunity to read through everything that he wrote, some 20,000 letters. And I wanted to distill his inspiration and his wisdom down to its essence and make it easily available for people today.
Well, you have done exactly that. To use a term of art from your trade, it's rather like a Jefferson Horn book. and I say that because you have divided it into easily digestible segments that if you will, take disparate portions of Jefferson's thinking and combine them topically, and I think it's a brilliant way of approaching him. What lit the fire under you about Mr. Jefferson?
Well, I've always been a great admirer of Jefferson, and when you encounter his thoughts, let's say down at the Jefferson Memorial or at his beautiful home Monticello in Charlottesville, Virginia. You wonder about the brilliance and insight of a person who could produce such spectacular works of architecture, literature, insight, and leadership for our country. So I had the chance to read through everything he wrote, as I mentioned, some 20,000 letters he wrote, and his language is elegant. He wrote in what you might call poetic prose, and he expressed ennobling thought. And so the more you read of what Jefferson actually wrote, as opposed to what various people have said about him, the more you're drawn into his world, and you realize what an elevated perspective he had on things, and what a glorious vision he had for our country and for the entire world. And I thought not too many people have the chance to read through 20 volumes of writing, as 20,000 letters. So since I had, I thought I would try to do everyone a favor and again, make his wisdom easily accessible today.
Well, I have to tell you, I mentioned in the first hour of this program that I would like to see copies of this sent to Alberto Gonzalez and Dick Cheney, most particularly the segment where Mr. Jefferson speaks about not trying to make a buck out of being in government.
He was sincere about that, because Jefferson basically died a pauper, did he not?
He did. He spent his entire life in service to his country. He did own the plantation there at Monticello and some other lands in Virginia. He was a farmer by trade, but he basically spent most of his time in the public service. He was governor of Virginia, president, vice president, many years a legislator, a diplomat in France, secretary of state. He founded the University of Virginia. All of these activities were designed to serve the public and inspire people to live higher and better lives, and he didn't really have much time to attend to his farming affairs. He incurred a lot of debt. He inherited debt. He incurred more debt when he was president because the salary wasn't large enough to act as president properly, as he saw. And he also guaranteed a large note of a friend in the 18-teens. And he always thought that his land could pay off his debts. He thought that the value of his land was greater than the value of his debts. But toward the last part of his life, his last 20 years, the land in Virginia became valueless, and he went from being a well-to-do, even wealthy individual, to essentially a pauper, and he died $100,000 in debt, and he was not able to pass his beloved Monticello on to his family because of it.
And in fact, for all his attempts to make being a farmer pay off, the only thing that ever turned a profit that he was involved with was the nailery on his property. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's pretty much the case. He did have a nailery to try to get into manufacturing a little bit, but that's right. He grew tobacco for many years. The American farmers in the South particularly were beholden to the British mercantile interest for loans and then the price of tobacco, which was manipulated as part of the colonial empire. He later turned to wheat, but there were several disastrous years of crops. The War of 1812, again after his presidency, disrupted American commerce with Britain, our main trading partner, throughout all those years. And he was never able to make a full and satisfactory living from the farming, even though he had all this this land. The land became essentially valueless and unsellable because most of the farmers, or many of them, moved out west to richer lands after Jefferson helped open up the West with the Louisiana Purchase and the Lewis and Clark and the expansion of America to become a continental nation. And that whole opening up of richer land depleted the value of his land. So what he thought was his real assets for the balance of his life just weren't there to be sold. And he did die in poor circumstances.
Do you feel comfortable giving what you've read, speculating? I know lawyers hate to speculate, but we're going to speculate anyway. Can you speculate as to how Mr. Jefferson would respond to the United States as it exists today?
Well, yes. I mean, I think that Jefferson was a great foe of fear and appeals to fear. He said that in order to procure tranquility, in fact, we must avoid fear and desire, which he called the two principal diseases of the mind. And he said, how much pain have cost us the evils which have never happened? In other words, we might say today, don't worry, be happy. He was constantly concerned that those in power would stoke the fears of the public and that would result in an erosion of our liberties. And it could well be argued that that's what's happened in the last 5 or 6 years, a constant drumbeat of fear coming at us from the government, from the media, and various sources, as excuses or reasons to erode our liberties. And to Thomas Jefferson, liberty, of course, was essential to his outlook on things. That's why I chose the title Light and Liberty for this book. He was a great foe of fear. He was a great foe of centralized power, and he was a staunch advocate for the Bill of Rights. Now, if you recall, the 1790s was a very difficult and bitter time in America where the Hamilton Party, the elitist party, as Jefferson saw, was opposed to the party of the common man, Jefferson and Madison's party, and they passed the infamous Sedition Act.
Yes.
And it made it a crime even to utter an opinion critical of the great Adams administration. And under that act, 24 newspaper editors, all from Jefferson's party, of course, and there weren't that many more,
right,
were arrested. 14 were prosecuted and 10 were jailed, and they were actually rotting in jail as political prisoners when he took office. And he had the chance to sort of turn the tables, extend extend the Sedition Act and jail his political opponents. He didn't do that, and by that magnanimous act, he established the principle of freedom of the press, freedom of speech, and he overcame the Federalist impulse for coercive control based on fear-mongering as manifested through the Sedition Act. And I think, you know, based on this description that I just went through, I think we can all see some of the parallels that exist in our own time.
And it's interesting because you mentioned those twin diseases. We have, it's not just the fear, Mr. Peterson, we have them both. Because we are reduced to a consumer culture in the first decade of the 21st century, where it's about the quality of one's TV, the make and model of one's automobile. All of our mass media is geared at convincing us that we don't have enough, and the word enough has almost become a vulgarity in what is called consumer culture.
You can see what you're talking about through his writings, because he, you know, I think we all associate Thomas Jefferson with the idea of the pursuit of happiness. That's his phrase in the Declaration of American Independence, which he authored as a right, a divinely given right, life, liberty, and then the third element was the pursuit of happiness. And as you say, there's been a fair distortion of what that idea really means. If we reduce the concept of happiness down to consumer satisfaction and acquisition of possessions and things like this, you really kind of strip out the real meaning of happiness as he conceived of it. He believed in what he regarded as the ancient Greek wisdom, which he said, as he summed it up, says happiness is the aim of life. Of course, that was his philosophy. And then he went on to say that virtue is the foundation of happiness, and utility is the test of virtue. So for something to be virtuous, it has to actually work as a practical matter to produce happiness. And what he meant by happiness, of course, was that lasting, abiding, true inner satisfaction on a higher plane than mere material possessions and acquisitions and so forth, but the happiness that's truly satisfying, that's lasting, that's based on virtues, the development of virtues and good qualities, service to others. You mentioned the organization of this book, Light and Liberty, and I chose to organize it in under 34 chapters, good qualities and virtues that we would all admire. Things like, as you say, not thirsting for gain, not fearing loss, sincerity, aspiration,
hope,
truth-seeking, hope, humility, enthusiasm, patience, gratitude, seeing the good in others, dreaming the impossible, patriotism, liberty, all these wonderful themes that we would all identify as virtues or good qualities, where if we pursue them as individuals and as a country, as a nation, as part of our national ideals, we'll be able to cultivate a deeper and more abiding sense of happiness and pursue happiness in the real, vital, moral, perhaps even spiritual sense in which Thomas Jefferson used it, where we can really find abiding peace and happiness within ourselves, a far cry from what many, many people are pursuing in our culture today.
Mr. Peterson, how do you think Thomas Jefferson would respond to the current media culture of attack and vituperation? What would Mr. Jefferson find in, say, Rush Limbaugh or Bill O'Reilly, the same sort of the hateful meanness that he found in the publisher of his day who tormented him over the Sally Hemings affair?
Well, there's a lot of similarities there, and you might sum it up this way. Thomas Jefferson was a great advocate of the practice of civility. He himself was an absolute gentleman. He was very dignified. He was the embodiment, you might say, of natural nobility. Friends who knew him described him as free, frank, easy, kind. One friend who met him said that the experience was like experiencing light from an inexhaustible solar fountain. And it was said that he astonished people's minds, as certainly as he won everyone's hearts. So he was a great believer in civility. He said that in social harmony, he said that without social harmony, life would be but a dreary thing. And he wrote that political differences need not and should not lead to personal animosities. And he said that, you know, he never saw an instance of one of two disputants convincing the other by arguing. And one of my favorite passages, which is included in the book, he said it was one of the things that it made Dr. Franklin, his good friend Benjamin Franklin, the most amiable of men in society, never to contradict anybody. If he were urged to announce an opinion, he did so by asking questions as if for information, or perhaps to suggest doubt. So you're right, Thomas Jefferson was bitterly attacked by vituperative opponents during his own days, but he always felt that civility, social harmony, reason, candor, moderation, respect, things like this, he valued very highly. He saw a lot of contentiousness in the United States Senate, for example, when he presided over it as vice president. And he was moved to write a handbook, a manual of parliamentary practice, it was called. And it was actually in use for 100 years before the current rules of Robert's Rules of Order came around. And he did it specifically to create a more respectful environment for people to conduct their social and political business.
Well, I wonder, and this is a bit dark, I suppose, Mr. Peterson. I wonder if we're past Mr. Jefferson's help. I read this passage in the essay that you have put together under the heading "Doing What Is Right." He says, "Give up money, give up fame, give up science, give up the earth itself and all it contains, rather than do an immoral act, and never suppose that in any possible situation or any under any circumstances it is best for you to do a dishonorable thing, however slightly so it may appear to you. Whenever you are to do a thing, though it can never be known but to yourself, ask yourself how you would act were all the world looking at you, and act accordingly. The precept of Providence is to do always what is right and leave the issue to Him." That doesn't square with most of the people, frankly, most of the people who get up and go to work in this country anymore.
Well, I think there's some truth to that, and I think that, you know, you see a lot of the political and social commentary, you know, in our national life, it reflects a concern, you know, about the cultural and moral direction, political direction of the nation. But Thomas Jefferson was, you know, was a great optimist. He believed in the future. He believed in the people. He was not an elitist. He said the good sense of the people will direct the boat ultimately to the proper point. And he said, I like the dreams of the future better than the history of the past. And he knew that he was a great believer in societal progress, if under the right conditions of education and public acceptance and tolerance and aspiration and so forth. At one time he wrote, we too shall encounter, this is very relevant today, I think, we too shall encounter follies, but if great, they will be short, if long, they will be light, and the vigor of our people will get the better of them. So I think if he were here with us today, he would certainly rue some of the evident, you know, moral and cultural declines, civility and so forth, prevalence of greed and things like this in our society and consumerism. But at the same time, he really did have faith in the average citizen. I mean, that was what the notion of all men are created equal was all about. Thomas Jefferson was the one who, in my view, really created the great American middle class by the vision that he set forth of all men are created equal. That's a principle in articulated in the Declaration of Independence. And it's, to me, that's the ultimate statement of humility, because he's saying that basically everyone in their deepest essence is neither superior nor inferior to anyone else. He wasn't saying everyone was equal in talents, merits, or virtues, but in their rights and their deepest essence, everyone is equal. And he had faith in the average citizen. He had faith that the people, if you will, through education and through aspiration for something higher and better, the special American dream, the vision that he articulated, would overcome periods of decline and doubt and challenge, like I believe that we're going through right now, and you seem to hold the same view.
Well, Sometimes I do get a little depressed, Mr. Peterson, and I have this vision of Jefferson sitting by the banks of the Potomac or out on the veranda at Monticello, sort of with his head in his hands, going, "No, no, no." Paris Hilton does that, creates that image for me. Is there a way back to his idealism, do you think?
Well, one of the reasons that I put Light and Liberty together was because I think if people could start reading the wisdom of our founders again, and particularly of Thomas Jefferson, who held the American vision, I think we can begin to rediscover our real feelings about what makes our country special. You know, Thomas Jefferson's vision, well, I sum it up as light and liberty, or you could say freedom and oneness. His vision was a vision of freedom and the rights of man and participatory self-government, equality, as I mentioned, and the pursuit of happiness. And it's also a vision of oneness, you might say, faith in the average citizen, a belief in the common good and universal harmony, and faith in an ever brighter future. And even as I say these words, I can kind of feel myself elevated. These are his words.
Mm-hmm.
This is his vision. And it's something that is at the source of our personal happiness, and the source of our national happiness. One of the things that he'd be sitting on the bank of the Potomac and shaking his head about, of course, is our international posture. You know, I think the public has turned sour on the situation in Iraq. And he would have had real clear views on it and very reasoned views about why it was wrong and essentially a misadventure. Because during his time, he and his fellow Americans were on the receiving end of other nations' assertions of national power, particularly France and Britain. But he foresaw the day when America might rise, you know, to become a great world power. And he said, "I hope our wisdom will grow with our power and teach us that the less we use our power, the greater it shall be." In other words, showing some self-restraint in economic or military power internationally, we actually gain the country more in the cooperation, respect, esteem, friendship of other nations than the actual use of the power itself would be. He said that every man and every body of men, every nation or society, possesses the right of self-government. I govern myself, you govern yourself, my nation governs itself, yours governs itself, and that's our duty, it's our right. And he was really against all forms of coercion, force, interference, meddling, and things like this. And he said, if there be one thing more deeply rooted in the mind of every American than any other, it is that we should have nothing to do with conquest. And at least in my view, I think Jefferson would call the Iraqi adventure a war of conquest.
I don't see how he could avoid it. Let me ask you then, because this is a progressive radio network and a progressive radio program, and we keep a pretty close eye on what the right wing is up to, and they take Mr. Jefferson and Mr. Franklin and Mr. Adams, Mr. Washington, they take them out and flog them like their own personal servants, and make certain declarations in line with their political vision out of what these gentlemen wrote and said. Have they missed the boat, or are they just using it opportunistically?
Well, I think it's interesting how Jefferson's thinking has been cited by opposing political, parties throughout American history. I mean, the North thought that Jefferson was the great advocate of freedom and emancipation of the slaves and so forth, and the South thought he was the great champion of states' rights. And each side found something to take out of Jefferson's thought. I think that, across the political spectrum, you see that being done today. One of the reasons I put Light and Liberty together was because if you get the essence of Jefferson's wisdom, it's very profound, it's very wise, it's very insightful, and if you absorb the whole basis of his thought, I think it's hard to come to some of the positions that the hard right wing groups in our country come to. Yes, we want to advance freedom, right? That's interesting.
Sure.
Jefferson was the great champion of liberty and freedom. That's why I chose that, for the title. He said in a very optimistic way, the ball of liberty is now so firmly in motion that will roll around the world. He was an optimist. He believed in with patience. You know, the ground of liberty is to be gained by inches, as he wrote. But if you only take that portion of his thought and not the light portion, the light that goes with liberty, says light and liberty go together. The light is you don't coerce other nations. You can't force representative Republican forms of government, Democratic Republican forms of government on other nations. It doesn't work. He thought countries and societies were like trees. He used the nature metaphor a lot. It grows very slowly. Enlightenment of the society through education, tolerance, respect, and so forth, valuing self-government above all of the blessings, as he said, that's a slow-growing process, the enlightenment of society and the progress of civilization. And he said light and liberty go together. And if you don't have that, you can't, a nation can't have liberty. That's why there's been slow progress toward liberty in our world, but it's been a lot of backsliding as well, because if a nation gets liberty or self-government through artificial means, like, you know, like wars or, you know, accidents or anything other than natural growth of the enlightenment of the society from within, it's not going to hold. And that would be his other critique of the Iraq experience. Not just that it was a war of conquest, and that's simply morally wrong, but it was that the Iraqi people, there's so much divisiveness. There's such they've got a ways to go on the road to, you know, enlightenment of tolerance of other individuals and groups and religions and so forth, that you can't get there overnight. And so there's a perversion of the ideal of liberty without recognizing the balance of the Jeffersonian wisdom, that it's their right to decide how they want to run their society. It's their obligation to progress in public education and gaining respect for each other, religious pluralism and tolerance and respect and so forth. And then you can gradually get to a situation where the society can hold together. But they're not there yet. And it was folly for anybody to think that they were. So he would be against it based on his own principles, for both the reasons that conquest is wrong and that the society needs to gain its own light in order to gain its own self-government.
And to the extent that he used those naturalistic metaphors, it would be very simple to say that the Iraqis at present time do not have the organic process whereby self-government or democracy or a Republican form of government can take root. It can't be imposed at the barrel of a gun over the course of 3 or 4 years.
It's like trying to get a tree, you know, to grow into a 200-foot beautiful mature tree, you know, from a sapling overnight. It's not going to happen. And unfortunately, at some point, and he used to get letters from people. This is Thomas Jefferson. He used to get letters from people in other countries when he was president and afterwards, saying, "You're the great champion of freedom and liberty and the rights of man and self-government and equality and so forth. Won't you please bless our revolution here in Ecuador or Peru or something like that?" And he would write back and say, I certainly do admire and support your efforts to gain freedom and the rights of man, but you have to recognize that the society has to be ready for it, and that I support what you're doing, but recognize that if your society as a whole isn't progressed, civilized, and advanced enough to handle self-government, you're going to lose it, and it'll slide back to what he called a tyranny of the one, the few, or the many. And, of course, the tyranny of the one would be a single dictator like Napoleon, a few would be an oligarch, and the many would be like the communist system and tyranny of the many.
Have we then gone in that retrograde motion, Mr. Peterson, do you think?
Well, it's very interesting. If you take, again, this principle of light and liberty, and light meaning education, tolerance, respect, and so forth, valuing self-government above all other blessings, and you say, do we have enough light to sustain our liberty? It's very easy to look around the world and say, well, maybe they don't. But you've got a good question there, Bob. Yeah, I think we seriously have to ask ourselves, do we have enough light to sustain our liberty? You know, can this be so? You know, when, as you mentioned earlier, so much of our public discourse is characterized by disrespect, you know, contempt, and even hatred. You know, when the common good, part of the vision of light and oneness and your respect and identification with your fellow man, the common good, is a notion that you don't hear about too much anymore. It almost sounds quaint. And when half of our eligible citizens who are eligible to vote don't even take the trouble to vote. Do we value self-government above all other blessings? Do we have enough light to sustain our liberties? It's very interesting. He had some simple questions that he thought an enlightened citizenry should ask about candidates for public office. And they're very simple. And if you think about the various candidates and office holders out there today, you can kind of get a handle of what Thomas Jefferson would feel about them. Here they are. Is he honest? Is he or she capable? Is he faithful to the Constitution? And is he a friend of peace and a friend of economy in the public expense? You know, five simple questions. He thought the answers, if an enlightened citizenry could identify candidates for office and answer those questions truthfully and insightfully about those candidates, they would pick the right leadership. And we would have, you know, we'd be on the road of progress again.
I have this vision of Jefferson on O'Reilly, and it just makes me want to run screaming from the room. Let me take you in a specific direction, if I may, Mr. Peterson, and I thank you for your time, by the way. This is so enlightening. Back during the debate on when Congress decided that it was bored with habeas corpus, I found a quote from Mr. Jefferson in which he stated that the very nature of habeas corpus as contained in the Constitution should be universally applicable, and that in the United States habeas corpus should be applicable to citizen and non-citizen alike. And I frankly stated it far more complexly than he did. How do we just cast these principles aside? I can't help but thinking that he would have been horrified by Guantanamo and Abu Ghraib and all the attendant abuses of our civil liberties that have been birthed out of this Iraq experience. He did talk in some fairly simple terms. Why are we unable to grasp that simplicity?
Well, I think it pretty much comes down to the climate of fear that has been created in our country from all the public sources that everyone is continually subjected to. You know, he called the habeas corpus the great writ. You know, the principle of habeas corpus has been around since the Magna Carta. It's been a good, you know, 800 years.
It's worked pretty well so far.
Through all of the, you know, English and now the American jurisprudence through the years, and it's simply the principle that a person cannot be arrested and imprisoned indefinitely by the government without the government bringing charges and having the accused person having the right to confront witnesses and so forth. It's such a basic protection of the rights of individual citizens, and it's been, you know, a cornerstone of English and American liberty for hundreds of years, and yet somehow in a climate of fear, we're talking about people who may not be American citizens, foreigners, you know, fear of attacks on the country and things like this, people are a little too ready to go along with the assault on that great right, freedom from arbitrary governmental arrest and imprisonment. They go along a little bit too easily. Now, there are voices out there. If you listen carefully, for example, to somebody like Senator Robert Byrd of Virginia, he has been a lone voice in the wind all these years, you know, focusing in on these abuses, which, you know, which Jefferson and people that adhere to Jeffersonian principles like Senator Byrd would clearly denounce as unpatriotic, as un-American, as simply wrong in fundamental moral, even spiritual terms, simply a deviation from the core, authentic American vision, the vision that Thomas Jefferson was the foremost articulator of. And to me, Thomas Jefferson's vision, particularly the rights of man, as you indicate, is the one thing that people around the world admire about America. You know, his vision, I think, is at the heart of what we love about our country. And if you flip through these pages in Light Liberty, the collection of his wisdom is pure Jefferson. There's no analysis, no spin, just his words only. And if you read through that, you get re-inspired immediately. Your feeling about yourself and your country gets lifted. He he really was an enlightened, noble thinker. And that vision is what we have temporarily lost, and people need to reconnect with the great, authentic American vision, an optimistic vision, faith in the future, faith in your fellow citizens, a distrust and a skepticism of our rulers. Thomas Jefferson was a great advocate of the dispersion of power. This was his sense of good government. He really believed in our federal system of limited power at the federal level, more at the state, most at the local. And, of course, at each level you split it into three branches, you know, to disperse it and check it and scatter it. He said you place under every individual what his own eye and hand may superintend. And he had a very clear statement as to why he thought the federal system of dispersed powers and stated rights of man in our Bill of Rights was so essential. He said, I do not agree that 14 out of 15 people are rogues, but I do believe that rogues would be uppermost. I do believe that rogues would be uppermost. In other words, self-interested people, rather than, as they were called at the time, disinterested people, or, you know, selfless serving, public serving people, would tend to seek the highest offices in the land. It's just the nature of things. And if they were successful in attaining that power, their tendency toward roguishness needed to be, you know, checked and constrained. Otherwise, they could do great damage to society, even in a system of dispersed federalized power. Ultimately, he believed that the responsibility for our liberties and our happiness rests with each citizen. He said that individual citizens in society are the only sure guardians of their liberties. And if he were here with us today, he would be looking around for examples of individual citizens, groups, voices in the media like yours, voices in elected leadership like Senator Byrd and so forth, speaking up for the right of habeas corpus, speaking up against abuses, coercion, fear, and so forth, the centralization of power by people who, at least in my judgment, have manifested their tendency toward roguish behavior.
So let us couch then these marvelous and inspiring words, Mr. Peterson, against the ledger of Thomas Jefferson, the man, because he did have feet of clay. Here is a man who spoke about the rights of all men being equal, who owned slaves. In opening the Louisiana Purchase, The people of Louisiana were not afforded the franchise for a considerable amount of time. The Native Americans, what eventually happened to them, is in many ways a door that was opened by Mr. Jefferson. Frankly, his ideas on politics and civility took a bit of a beating in his machinations to destroy Aaron Burr. Does the fact that he proved himself entirely human in his presidency in any way negate the beauty of these words?
Well, I'm a great, you know, admirer of Thomas Jefferson. I feel like I and all of us really in this time are or should be friends of Thomas Jefferson, because he worked his heart out in all the different legislative and executive and diplomatic and educational posts that his fellow man Americans allowed him to serve in. So I'm obviously a great admirer, and I do consider myself a friend of Jefferson across the reach of time.
No, as do I.
So let's take a couple of the items that you mentioned, in case your listeners may share similar concerns about, you know, was he a hypocrite for holding slaves and these kinds of challenges that have been lodged at Jefferson through the years. Let's go back to the nature metaphor and the growth. The slow growth of the tree of liberty, and again the idea that light and liberty go together. Now, he once wrote that enlighten the people generally, and tyranny and oppression of body and mind will vanish like evil spirits at the dawn of day. And again, the ground of liberty is to be gained by inches. So he's clearly saying that you have to accept where you are in society and recognize that things, just like the growth of plant life in nature, temperature occurs slowly and organically over time. You simply can't force progress to be super accelerated. And I'm mentioning this in the context of the slavery issue because in the past 10 to 20 years, many critics have attacked Jefferson for espousing principles of equality and freedom and at the same time holding other human beings in slavery against their will. So maybe a few thoughts, and items of information along that way would sort of help maybe moderate some of the harsh views that, that people tend to hold of Thomas Jefferson. He was a slaveholder, and of course, during those days, everybody in Virginia who had any land held slaves because they had to.
It was the economic system.
And it's the economic system, and if you had paid labor, you're out of business, and everyone else was holding slaves. So it was like intrinsic in society. Now he was very treated his slaves very, very well. He treated his members of his extended family essentially. He was not a slave trader. He inherited the slaves. He tried to educate them in skills and crafts. After all, he ran a nailery, largely an agricultural society. No one traveled more than 30 miles from home. And he felt that, again, accepting society as he found it, as he was born into it, he looked around and many, the great majority of the African Americans had recently arrived there in the last generation or two. They were new to the country, new to the culture, and even learning to speak the language. And he said, you know, would I be doing any of these people any great favors? Would it be an act of kindness to send them on their way and let them fend for themselves without training them in a skill, in a craft, in a trade that they could use to support themselves and not be dependent on anybody else? And so he did that, and at the same time, he argued strongly for the enlightened, if you will, the white man's mind, the white man who, of course, we can all imagine back at that time, looked at the African-Americans as almost subhuman, looked down upon the African-Americans with great contempt and a sense of superiority, the very absence of humility. And so he said, we have to enlighten the white man's mind over time, gradually, because you can't change anything overnight. And you have to train the black man, give them skills, traits, so they can survive as independent, self-sufficient people with dignity and pride, not dependent on anybody else. And he knew that would take a long time. But he worked assiduously for it. He never freed any of his slaves on his death. They weren't his to free. As you mentioned, he was in bankruptcy. He thought he had the land to pay his debt, but in the last 20 years of his life, he didn't. So he couldn't free them. His creditors allowed him to free six, and even then, that was really their act of grace. He did free three slaves in the 1790s because he thought they could sustain themselves in the economy at the time. They were trained as chefs and other trades, and unfortunately, they all committed suicide because they were essentially lost in the broader society.
I had no idea.
Society, and unable to provide for themselves. So on a personal level, he was very concerned about the welfare of those entrusted to him, his slaves, and what would the environment be for their greater happiness. He also did a tremendous amount, way more than any other founding father, on the public stage, in the realm of laws and proposed laws, to provide for the rollback of slavery and their eventual emancipation. I know I'm going on quite a bit about this, but...
No, please. That's what we're designed to do here, Mr. Peterson.
The personal side of Jefferson, slavery, I just went through that. He really felt that they were essentially his younger brothers, and he wanted them to be able to fend for themselves when the day of freedom and the broader society eventually came. But on the public stage, you know, he did a lot of things that people aren't generally aware of. In fact, I was not aware of until I commenced my study of his writings. Now, as you mentioned, Jefferson was a lawyer. And one of the first cases that he argued in his 20s was a case called Howell versus Netherland, which was a case over an effort of a young black man to attain freedom and based on various circumstances of birth and parentage and so forth. And in that case, Jefferson argued he used the words, all men are born free. And he was shouted down in court for his heresy, that going against the written laws of Virginia, which of course they weren't free. He was arguing for broader, higher principles, just like the principles that sustained the Declaration of Independence, life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness being divinely or naturally given rights beyond any written codes of man. When he wrote the Declaration of Independence, he included two paragraphs declaiming the slave trade run by the British under King George and the mercantilist empire, the British Empire. In the most ringing terms, he said, he, the King of England, hath suffered men to be bound in chains and dragged thither across the great ocean to this land where they were sold into oppression. Things like this, the denouncing...
That didn't play with the South Carolina delegation,
yes,
did it?
Those paragraphs were struck at the insistence of the South Carolina and Georgia delegations. You roll to the 1780s now. America is now free. He's in Congress. He's writing a law to provide for the what happens in the newly acquired territory. And his draft of the law said, after the year 1800, there shall neither be slavery nor involuntary servitude in the newly admitted states and territories. Now, that law was the predecessor of the famous Northwest Ordinance of 1787, which was actually enacted, and it was defeated by one vote. And he later said that in that awful moment, the fate of unborn millions was sealed. And in statements like that, he essentially predicted the Civil War, the Armageddon of the Civil War, where 600,000 Americans were killed. Over what issue?
Slavery.
The expansion of territory. Slavery into the new territory. And finally, he wrote a constitution for Virginia in the 1780s, which provided for the gradual emancipation of the slaves after the year 1800, and their owners would be gradually compensated over time, and anyone born after 1800 when they reached the age of 21 would be freed, and it would be a gradual rolled out, again, organic thing to prevent a great cataclysm, but do it gradually over many, many decades, and that constitutional provision was not adopted. So in these kinds of actual public assertions and proposed laws and court statements and so forth, Thomas Jefferson, more than anybody else, the founding of our country, tried to do concrete things to roll back and ameliorate the condition of slaves. And when I look at what happened after he died on July 4th, 1826, the same day as his good friend and rival John Adams, and they both died on the 4th of July. I think he might ask us the question, what about the people that came after him and the founding generation? What did they do to try to roll back slavery, emancipate the enslaved Americans, provide for their education, craft, training? And what did they do to enlighten the mind of the white man to receive these individuals into a fully integrated society? When you think about it, not much was done. It took the Civil War, the Great Cataclysm. 5% of the entire American population was killed in the Civil War. 600,000 people, 30 million Americans. You compare that today, that's like 6 million people today in a population of 300 million. The cataclysm is unbelievably massive. Over what? Over the failure of America as a society to train African Americans to be independent, to train the mind of the white society in a more enlightened fashion. And you went on to the Ku Klux Klan, the Night Riders. You went on to segregation, Jim Crow. And what Jefferson was advocating about, the principles he was hoping that subsequent generations would pick up on about the enlightening of society and fair and equal treatment and dignity for everyone weren't really embraced by the American society until the 1960s. That's 150 years after Thomas Jefferson. So for those who would criticize Thomas Jefferson about slavery, these are some thoughts that perhaps might give them pause.
Well, they certainly do me. I also mentioned the legislation you mentioned him drafting, by 1800. I was born and raised in Alabama. That would have prevented Alabama from entering the Union as a slaveholding state.
Something as simple as that could easily have negated much of the advent of the Civil War. I find that, well, that's something I'm going to be chewing on for a while. Mr. Peterson, with this with this book and in his words, you've crafted these essays, and I get the idea that they're not necessarily in any particular essay. It's not necessarily all from one document or all from one letter or all from one writing. So I don't get necessarily a sense of time or place out of them, but rather of ideas. You mentioned Jefferson's death in 1826 on the 4th of July. By that time, had he begun to reflect on the nature of the experiment? Had he begun to form any opinions as to its likelihood of ongoing success or failure?
Well, he was concerned about that because he had dedicated his whole life to the great American experiment. He called it the great experiment, which was to prove whether or not man is capable of living under laws self-imposed, capable of self-government. That was his great. That was the great challenge that America was to demonstrate the experiment, to demonstrate whether or not man was capable of governing himself, as opposed to, you know, the tyranny, the traditional, he called it the government of kings, priests, and nobles, which was, you know, all throughout.
It's fairly succinct.
He had the kings, priests, and nobles, the governing class, the rulers, the priests, the alliance of churches with states. He was obviously opposed to that. And the nobles, being the moneyed, well-to-do classes, he said all three of those types of groups of society always allied themselves together. And he and his fellow founders worked to create a system of government and ideas and practice and principles that would show that self-government, respecting the rights of man, is possible. He did have some doubts from time to time based on things that happened during the course of his lifetime, but he really was, an optimist. He said that the American Constitution was the primitive experiment which was designed to show whether or not man is capable of self-government. And he said it was a primitive and precious model of what is to change the condition of man all over the globe. He said that America was the hallowed ark of human hope and happiness. And he wrote that America possesses the sacred fire of liberty and self-government, which is to light up the other nations of the earth, if the other nations shall ever become susceptible of its benign influence. So this is a lofty and at the same time practical vision of Thomas Jefferson. He worked his whole life to achieve it. I think he died happy, and I think he died optimistic that the vigor of the people, as I said earlier, would get the best of our follies. He was a great optimist, and that's one of the reasons why when you read his writings, it's an ennobling thought. You just feel great, not only about your own life and your own prospects for improvement in our own struggles to improve ourselves, but also our national struggle for progress, advancement, enlightenment.
Well, I certainly appreciate all that. We scheduled this for about 25 minutes, and we've run way over, and I appreciate your time, Mr. Peterson, because it has been an enlightening experience. Are you going to take this anywhere else beyond this book? Is there something else coming? Do you have further plans for Mr. Jefferson?
I've really been enjoying opportunities like the one that you've so kindly given me here this evening in this wonderful phone call. And I've had the chance to talk to students, for example. He was a great advocate of education. And whenever I talk to students, I really see that when they hear these authentic American visionary principles, they really gravitate to them. I'm having a wonderful time just talking about and trying to bring the light of Thomas Jefferson back into the American sky. If I might, we have a website for this book. It's actually the name of the book, www.lightandliberty.org. And it's just wonderful to have a chance to talk to different groups and in different forums about Jefferson's light. I'm trying to really encourage people to read Thomas Jefferson again and get acquainted with his wonderfully inspiring wisdom. And we've had some great comments on Jefferson's wisdom from some well-known international figures. I've been quite surprised to learn how much much Jefferson is regarded, how positively he's regarded by people around the world, perhaps even more so than people here at home these days. We had Archbishop Tutu, for example, said that Jefferson's wisdom and light liberty has the power to capture the imagination and energize those of us in the present day world to, again, dream great dreams and do good deeds. My other favorite one came from President Gorbachev, the great Mikhail Gorbachev, the one who freed hundreds of millions in Europe from the yoke of communist tyranny and took the threat of massive nuclear annihilation of the world out of the picture. He said that the lessons of Thomas Jefferson can be very valuable to us today as we're learning to live together in concert and harmony and to strengthen relations with one another. So it's been a wonderful journey, and it's just great to have the opportunity to share the appreciation of what really makes our country special, is the vision of Thomas Jefferson, with great Americans such as yourself.
Well, thank you, Mr. Peterson. I take that as high praise. And the website is already posted at our network website. I hope people will visit lightandliberty.org. I hope they will purchase this book. Frankly, I don't know how we could possibly encourage it, but I would like... I wish this book could be in every high school and junior high school library in this country, because among other things, one of the things that I've bemoaned from time to time is that shortly after I left high school, it seems that high schools across the American continent, across the nation, quit teaching civics, and it is the absence of that fundamental understanding of the nature of this American experiment that puts us at such peril. We need our mythology, but we more than that, we need the dreams and the ambitions and the hopes and the optimism, as you have noted it, that Mr. Jefferson brought to his own contemplations of what he wanted this nation to be. And sometimes I fear that I get a little paranoid, and I wonder if some of that that removal of that level of teaching and that level of exposure to this kind of thinking has been a deliberate act. So I appreciate everything you've done.
I think it may be to a certain extent, but I think it's just simply a loss of focus on what's really important. I mean, we're deluged with so much information and so much stimulation today. I mean, Jefferson was a great advocate of simplicity and silence. Things like this, contemplation, because he believed that, you know, truth can be found within, and we're so overstimulated today and so overwrought with information and opportunities in ways that our society hasn't been in the past, that it, in a certain way it's understandable that we've been knocked off of our balance a little bit, and we've lost our focus on what's really important. But I've had the opportunity to speak to a number of student groups and teachers, and they do, whenever they learn about the project, they love, several schools have, you know, actually bought a number of copies of the book to include in the library, as you so kindly suggested, and have had, you know, the classes of students, you know, gathered to, you know, to talk about Thomas Jefferson's vision. I've given a number of talks there, and when you see that in action, you know, your hope and your confidence in your country, you know, begins to be restored a little bit, because there's intrinsic elevating power in the thought and the wisdom of Thomas Jefferson. And when people are exposed to it, particularly young people, they really embrace it. And it gives them something positive positive way of looking at their lives and their country and their society. And it's really the authentic American vision. And I think so many people I know are hungering to get back to the real America. And they're looking for truth in the vision and the wisdom of the founders of our country. And I think that's why you see so much interest in the founders, the great, you know, Madison and Franklin, all the greats. It's because there's a hunger there. They know that we've lost something. And I think, you know, even the fact that, you know, you so kindly, you know, offered me this time to discuss these kind of issues with you tonight, it, you know, shows that the country hungers to get back to its roots, the authentic American vision. But I'm sure that Jefferson would be an optimist if he were with us, and he would applaud every effort of every teacher, of every host like yourself and people in Congress those who are looking for a better America. He would applaud all that, and he would enjoy the sense that we're really going to make something great out of this country again, and again become a beacon of hope for everyone around the world.
And I hope he can be that beacon again. You know, it's funny that the number of levels on which Mr. Jefferson affects us in so many different ways. I'm in a very rural setting, Mr. Peterson. I'm in West Virginia. And
there you go, Senator Byrd.
Exactly. And I love to get a garden in. Didn't get one in this year. But I never plant a tomato that I don't think of Mr. Jefferson. I kid you not. Because by virtue of the visionary that he was as an agronomist as well, at that point in time, most people believed the tomato to be poison.
Yes, because there was some negative quality about the leaves of the tomato, I think. But
it's a kissing cousin of deadly nightshade.
Yes.
And it was Mr. Jefferson who began putting tomato dishes on the table at Monticello. And the American love affair with the tomato began with Mr. Jefferson. So many different means by which he touched the future, and whether he knew it or not, I'm not certain. But to get in touch with him, to be connected to him, to have that very visceral connection that it's obvious you have with him, must certainly be an ennobling experience. And you have shared that experience with us, and I sincerely hope that that this book will find its way into thousands and nay millions of hands, because one of those hands, Mr. Peterson, one of those hands is the next Jefferson.
He would share that optimism, and I think that, you know, if your listeners want to envision a wonderful experience, they can contemplate taking a trip to Monticello, his beautiful home there in Charlottesville. So classical, so eloquent, so tasteful, so inspiring. It's a beautiful natural setting there, the Blue Ridge Mountains there stretching out to the southwest. The wonderful gardens and trees and everything that went along with his house. Take the tour and take a copy of his words, his vision, his wisdom, his light, liberty. And after they're done the tour, particularly if you have, you know, children that are maybe young teenagers and looking to form their world vision, sit out on the side of the mountain for the rest of the afternoon and contemplate nature's beauty and read the wonderfully inspiring philosophy of Thomas Jefferson. It'll really be a well-spent day.
I can think of no better, truly. Mr. Peterson, thank you very kindly for your time. And I hope sometime perhaps again we can talk at perhaps even further length to flesh out a few more ideas. But I know you're talking to folks all over the country, and I hope you can, I hesitate to use the word because he might have objected, but this is a gospel of Thomas Jefferson here, because it is good news within the meaning of the Greek word itself. This is hope for America, and I hope you can spread it, and I hope from a spark can become a raging flame.
Bob, I really want to sincerely thank you for your support of this project. It's richly enjoyable and satisfying to share these ideas with you. I really appreciate the time that you've given me tonight, and I really commend the work that you're doing.
Thank you very kindly, Mr. Peterson, and best of luck.
And to you as well. Thank you very much.
Bye now. Eric Peterson, Light and Liberty, Reflections on the Pursuit of Happiness. This is not Mr. Peterson's idea of what Jefferson might have said. These are Jefferson's own words pulled together into little mini essays. For anyone who loves the idea of the American experiment, and I know many of you listen as well as this program to that of our very dear friend Mike Malloy. And you have heard him on a number of occasions bemoaning and wondering whether the American experiment is over and wondering what happens next. I would submit to you that if we could reach some form of critical mass whereby these words were in the hands of, I don't want them in, you know, what Mr. Peterson said, he identified kings, priests, and nobles as being the problem that makes difficult self-government. I don't want this book in the hands of kings, priests, and nobles, because as kings, priests, and nobles are wont to do, they will pervert these words. I've asked you to buy a lot of books. And frankly, I ask you to buy them through our website because we get 0.971653 cents per purchase. And someday, after you've bought a million books, we're going to get a check for a buck from Amazon. Okay? I want you to buy this book. I want you to own this book. If you've got the money to do it, I'd like you to buy 5 copies of this book. And I'd like for you to give it away. I'd like for you to give it to your local public library. I'd like to see you give it to your local junior high school. Because somebody's going to find this book. Somebody's going to find these words. And somebody finding these words and putting them in action is going to save this once great nation. There I go, telling you what to do again. Shame on me. We're going to take a little break for the news. We'll come back. Your phone calls. 304-658-5453, 877-443-2366, 877, the number 4, head on. Let's talk about it. Let's talk about anything you want to talk about. This is Conversation Radio. You know that. This is The Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid.
You're gonna go, I know.
This is the Head On Radio Network, The Horn.
This is Billy Shears. Join us this Friday at 11 a.m. Eastern on Fox Talk with John Fox. We'll take a look at the tragic death of the Rolling Stones founder, Brian Jones. Was it an accident, a suicide, or was there just something more to it?
He started pleading, "Oh, come on, now, come on, let me go, will you?"
It's not a case that was investigated as a possible homicide.
We did not mean to kill him.
This is Billy Shears, and hey, thanks for lending an ear.
I'm getting so sick of hearing people try to minimalize what's going on. And China's up to it now, too. This idea that, you know, we're going to try and make moves, but not at the detriment to our economy. Hello! How many times do I have to say this? No planet, no economy. No planet, no business. No planet, no commerce. Drives me absolutely insane. And like I said last week, we have George W. Bush pressuring the G8 to soften their language while at the same time making public statements to tell the G8 to get with the program. Excuse me? What bloody planet are you on?
Join me for Foxed Up here on the Head On Radio Network. Moving to 10 a.m. weekdays, Monday, June 18th, here on the Head On Radio Network.
Those people I know.
This is the Quality News Network. President Bush has announced he supports federal funding up front for border security. The move was made today as he sought the support of key senators to revive the failing immigration bill. President says he wants $4.4 billion to go immediately toward helping secure the borders. A judge has ruled that former White House aide Louis Scooter Libby must go to prison while he appeals his conviction. Libby must report to prison within the next 6 weeks. The former chief of staff of Vice President Dick Cheney was sentenced to 2.5 years for lying during the investigation into the exposure of a CIA agent's identity. In the Gaza Strip, Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas has declared a state of emergency and dissolved the unity government. Hamas pushed out its Fatah rivals and has taken control of the area, declaring the Gaza Strip is now under Islamic rule, and it will become an Islamic state. There are reports of executions in the streets. South of Baghdad, 3 Sunni mosques were torched in an apparent retaliation for yesterday's bombing of the minarets of a revered Shiite shrine, the Golden Mosque. Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki has sent in extra security forces to try and secure the peace. Iraqi sectarian violence has increased in the past 3 months. That's according to the mandatory quarterly report from the Pentagon to Congress. Top congressional leaders sent President Bush a letter yesterday that bluntly declared the Iraq troop surge policy has failed. The administration says it's too early to judge. The Army is planning on hiring more psychiatrists to help the huge number of soldiers returning from war with mental problems. The Associated Press reports the Army will spend $33 million to hire the psychiatrists, psychologists, and social workers. The space shuttle Atlantis is conserving energy by turning off cameras, computers, and some lights. It's docked with the International Space Station and may stay up there a day longer than originally planned. At the moment, it's using its thrusters to help stabilize the station. Crews are still trying to figure out what caused the failure of Russian computers that control orientation and oxygen production. The wife of evangelist Billy Graham has died. Ruth Graham was 87. The couple married more than 60 years ago. You're listening to the Quality News Network. We have science and business news coming up after the break.
Hi, I'm George Lopez. In comedy, there are some things you can count on to get a smile. In healthcare, Shriners Hospitals for Children have a proud tradition of bringing smiles to kids with orthopedic burn and spinal cord problems. Shriners offer world-class medical care to children absolutely without charge. At all 22 Shriners Hospitals, innovative research and teaching programs are combined with specialized pediatric services for one purpose, to improve the lives of children. For more information, call 1-800-237-5055. Shriners, having fun and helping kids.
There was this man who almost learned to walk at a rehab center that almost got built by people who almost gave, almost gave. How good is almost giving? About as good as almost walking. As generous a nation as we are, sometimes instead of giving, we almost give. Don't almost give. Give. Visit our website at don'talmostgive.org. A message from the Ad Council.
The TB patient who set off a public health scare by taking several international flights recently will have surgery to remove part of his infected lung. Doctors say next month they'll take out a tennis ball size area of Andrew Speaker's lung tissue infected with an extremely drug-resistant tuberculosis. A recall is in effect for 5-ounce tubes of toothpaste labeled as Colgate Palmolive. The product sold in 4 states, but it may be Chinese counterfeit containing toxic material used in antifreeze. Sold in New Jersey, New York, Pennsylvania, and Maryland, the product says it's imported from South Africa but has many typos on the label. 30-year fixed mortgage rates went up this week to 6.74%. That's the highest level in nearly a year. Wholesale inflation went up in May as gas prices went up more than 10% in the month. And GM and Ford and Chrysler say they'll seek major concessions from the United Auto Workers during the summer's contract talks. The companies say their financial problems are exacerbated by wages and benefits of those workers. Light sweet crude is trading at $68.30 a barrel on the New York Mercantile. At the close of Wall Street, the Dow Jones was up 71 points at 13,553. The NASDAQ ended up 17, and the S&P up 7. There's more at QualityNewsNetwork.com. I'm Laurel Krissen.
Tonight's final hour of Head On begins next. 1-877-4-HEAD-ON. That's 1-877-443-2366. Here's Buck.
Coffee break's over. Back on your heads. I'm still reeling from that conversation. It was wonderful. I want to share something with you. This is from page 94 of the book. Because I think it has a lot to do with what is behind the Head On Radio Network, the Horn. In the chapter entitled Forgiveness, Mr. Jefferson writes, "When I hear another express an opinion which is not mine, I say to myself, he has a right to his opinion, as I to mine. Why should I question it? His error does me no injury, and I shall become a Don Quixote to bring all men by force of argument to one opinion. If a fact be misstated, it is probably he is gratified by a belief of it, and I have no right to deprive him of the gratification. If he wants information, he will ask for it, and then I will give it in measured terms. But if he still believes his own story and shows a desire to dispute the fact with me, I hear him and say nothing. It is his affair, not mine, if he prefers error. I tolerate with the utmost latitude the right of others to differ from me in opinion without imputing to them criminality. I know too well the weakness and uncertainty of human reason to wonder at its different results." Isn't that what we're doing? We are sharing information, we are discussing, we are dialoguing, we are seeking correct answers. Meanwhile, the ditto monkeys and the increasingly aged demographic that actually thinks that Bill O'Reilly speaks truth go prating on and you know, come 4th of July. Come 4th of July, some members of the Bush administration will fan out like crabgrass on a nice lawn, and they'll flog poor Mr. Jefferson to death again. And I'm getting to the point where I hate the 4th of July. I loathe the 4th of July. I despise the 4th of July. I feel probably worse about the 4th of July than the denizens of Vicksburg did, who didn't celebrate it for 100 years. Because the 4th of July, as it is observed in the United States now, is an abomination. It is an anathema. It is a tarted up, camped up, creeped up, ginned up, dummied up, faked up, frauded up caricature of everything that transpired on that hot, humid, muggy, wet, damp, uncomfortable, ugly 4th of July afternoon in Philadelphia in 1776. But lo and behold, you know, you'll be then. That's the day that I stand on the porch and read the Declaration of Independence out loud to the bees and the grass and the kids, because they're very real words. But to have them, you know, 4th of July is going to come around, and you're going to get a circular from Walmart with Thomas Jefferson's picture on it. And I should take his measured approach. It does me no harm. Oh, but Lord, it does this country harm. It does his experiment harm. You know? To the phones we go. Chris is calling from Alabama. Hey, Chris, welcome to the program.
Hey, buddy, how you doing?
I'm holding on, man.
Well, you know, as the bumper music going out there said, alligator lizards in the air. Well, they're in there, you know, because John McCain's Straight Talk Express, I can hear it, you know, buzzing over the rooftops. And as the loss of cabin pressure and the truth serum kicks in, he starts opening up about that relationship with Scooter Libby. And
yeah.
You know, you can draw your own conclusions.
Yeah, I've gotten through almost 2.5 hours of radio without mentioning the fact that Scooter Libby's "Please don't send me to jail, Judge" plea failed. Sometimes I'm not very good at current events.
I was gone for a little while, and I was gone from the show during the time that the old cat boy removed his name from the World Bank.
Oh, yeah, you mean Bill Frist.
Catboy. I can't imagine the World Bank and the WTO and PETA all being together. I just can't imagine that. But you just never know. You just never know. Mitt Romney renting out the Boston Garden and all that for financing. You know, come give us $5,000 and we'll give you a barbecue plate and we'll comp your room. Boy, I tell you.
Freedom.
Yeah. But they got, but if, just one joke that I was going to say, it's just so ridiculous. This is just stupid, so I'll just go and say it. Have you heard about the new show about the Republican candidate that's on the Discovery Channel? It's called Deadliest Catch. That's so easy.
Yes, it is.
That is just so easy. One of my favorite quotes of Thomas Jefferson, the man who reads nothing at all is better educated than the man who reads nothing but newspapers.
You know, he had a right to be a little bit bitter.
Yeah, he did.
Because, and I thought what Mr. Peterson, the circumstances as Mr. Peterson described it, were correct, and they were also telling. Because Thomas Jefferson could have extended the reach of the Sedition Act, and we would have reached fascism a whole lot quicker.
Yeah.
But instead, he freed the jailed political prisoners, the newspaper editors. He wiped out the Sedition Act, and the minute he wiped out the Sedition Act, his opponents began gloriously and joyously and rambunctiously tormenting him. Have you heard? Mr. Jefferson has a black lady for a mistress. Yes, he does. He does. He really does. And to this day, it's neither proven nor disproven.
Well, you know.
But that bit of calumny has come down through history, and you know, why was it was calumny then? Why does it matter now?
What if Jefferson would have invested in Whitewater?
Oh God! With the Republican Congress, Mr. Jefferson would have been hounded out of office and impeached because every square inch of dirt that Monticello sat on was a failed land deal.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah, I mean, they would have had so many people lining up to slap him with a glove.
I know. I mean,
the poor man, he would have had a skeletal face after a while.
I sure would love to see a copy of this in the library down at dear old Florence High School, Chris. I really, really would.
Well, I tell you, if you need to
get hold of our buddy Kyle and tell him to get hold of the acquisitions manager down at the Florence Lauderdale Public Library and make sure it goes in there, too.
Well, you know, he is in charge of, actually, he has a hand in getting books on religion into the library.
Well, but this is politics.
Well, you never know.
But I am going to send him a link to the book, and I'm going to suggest that it's a must-have.
Well, you know, he's moved up in the ranks over the last year or so, so he might can do a good job of getting it in there.
That'd be great if he could.
Look at the Albanian flag.
Oh, no.
My last post...
Has it got a watch on it? Or was that Bulgaria where they stole the watch?
I don't remember. It was Albania. Look at the Albanian flag. The last report on the Minister Report, I have posted it in the last 3 or 4 days, and I feel terrible about it. But it's got this two-headed creature. One's facing one way, the other's facing another way. And it's got this claws stuck out. And it looks like a two-headed beast of something.
Yeah, I'm looking at it now.
Bush and Cheney. Look at it, man. All it needs is an upside-down American flag in the middle, and there's the Bush administration right there, buddy. And rats being sacrificial lambs jumping off into the bottomless pit that is DuPont Circle. That would be just perfect.
Oh, you're a sad, twisted soul, what? Chris. You're a sad, twisted man.
No, I'm just acquainted with reality.
Yep.
And when it comes down to the presidential race and the last debate, everybody's going to decide who they're going to vote for, Republican or Democrat, and it's Al Gore and Fred Dalton Thompson debating. Just wait and see.
Fred
Thompson. That's my prediction. Yeah. That is... Now,
I don't know. Well, I mean, will he have to take breaks to go and? No, okay.
He'll have to go and do that. Yeah.
No, that was just going to be nasty.
But I agree with Willie Nelson. Kucinich is the man.
Yeah, he is. He's got more common sense than the rest of them put together.
But if Al doesn't get in the race, Fred's going to walk away with it. Now I'm a good, strong independent, and I'll back my independent seed to the kingdom come, but we also have a nation full of people that have voted him in office twice in a row that...
I've seen him on Law and Order. He'd be a great president.
And he's talking about bringing back the bile of Reagan. And there's a whole bunch of people out there that show up to the polls.
He can't possibly win with a 25-year-old wife.
You want to bet?
Yeah, well.
You want to bet?
No, I don't.
I'm telling you, I get this queasy E. coli-like feeling in my gizzard that tells me that if somebody like Al doesn't get in there, that everybody can believe in, and everybody will back that's already won already.
Fred will chomp on that cigar and chew Hillary up and spit her out.
He'll do it to her. He'll do it to Obama. He's going to do it to every one of them. If Al doesn't get in the race, I'll tell you right now, he's going to be the next president. He's building up a groundswell.
Trying to make me start drinking before the show's over, aren't you, Chris?
He's building up a groundswell. You've read the behind-the-scenes stuff that's going on.
Oh, yeah.
He's building it up. I don't want it.
I don't want it either, brother. I don't want it either.
I was in high school during the Reagan years, and I remember, well, in Alabama, I had Bob James as a governor. I had Reagan as president.
Talk about, I mean, man, that's playing pool behind a pair of eight balls, isn't it?
We were strapped under the floor, and we couldn't see who was swinging the stick, but we knew we was going to get hit. It was terrible.
Oh, I know.
And I don't want to go through it again, but I got a feeling that's what's...
Hey, I remember turning down a shot at the U.S. Naval Academy because Ronald Reagan became president. You know, that's one of those little forks in the road in a life. Hey, Chris, we got to roll on, brother.
All right, take care.
Good talking to you, my friend.
All right.
Hey, is it rained down there yet?
About 5-6 days ago, it rained for 20 minutes, and I almost cried. I was so happy.
Okay.
So I'm out watering my garden every 2 days.
Oh, brother. We'll talk to you later, man.
All right.
Bye now. Okay, I had to change there. I'm going right back to the phones. But Agnes is going to fire up a quick break. She's going to get out of the chair. I'm going to get out of the chair. She's going to go and pick up the boy at football camp. Then we will continue the last half hour of Conversation Radio for a Thursday evening. You're listening to America's Liberal Voice. You're listening to The Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid.
I'm getting so sick of hearing people try to minimalize what's going on. And China's up to it now, too. This idea that, you know, we're going to try and make moves, but not at the detriment to our economy. Hello! How many times do I have to say this? No planet, no economy. No planet, no business. No planet, no commerce. Drives me absolutely insane. And like I said last week, we have George W. Bush pressuring the G8 to soften their language while at the same time making public statements to tell the G8 to get with the program. Excuse me? What bloody planet are you on?
Join me for Foxed Up here on the Head On Radio Network, moving to 10 a.m. weekdays, Monday, June 18th, here on the Head On Radio Network.
Those people I know.
Brought to you by the Republican National Committee. George W. Bush, Maximum Decider.
Next time you see a stranger on a plane, a stranger with those swarthy looks we all know, ask yourself, shouldn't I be afraid? Maybe he wants to kill me. Maybe he hates us for our freedom. Fear. It's what's for dinner.
There's one place on the web you can go that's so topical you can apply it liberally. WD40.com. WDYAD40.com. Wad Wally and Doopie are there. They're working hard every day to give you updates in news, politics, and
and a great sense of humor. So stop on by and see the boys at WD40.com, a place where you can raise your voice and be heard. WD40.com, your one-stop shop for all things progressive.
Okay, what possessed me to play that? I'll never know. No, I'll tell you what possessed me to play that. Desperation. I had to find a bumper, piece of bumper music, and these Swifty chair changes are kind of kind of exciting. But enough of that. Let's go straight to the phones. Our good friend Albert, calling from Wisconsin, has been waiting. Hey, Albert, welcome to the program.
Hey, good evening, Bob. How are you?
Yeah, I'm okay. You?
You survived the thunderstorm, so I'm doing all right. That was a really good interview you gave there with, was it Peterson?
Yeah, Eric Peterson.
Yeah, yeah, because I think with anyone who really understands this country and understands, like, I think it is when, like, everyone uses those feel-good words, you know, about America, like, you know, the freedom, and, you know, now, you know, they're turning those words into the doublespeak words, but, you know, when we hear those words of freedom and, you know, democracy and republic and all the things that we do love this country for, well, I think all of that really kind of stems from Jefferson. With a little Ben Franklin sprinkled into the mix, and you know, I do think that he's definitely one of my favorites, and for you know more than just even his words, but just for his actions, and you know, I mean, there's so many paths of inspiration you can find with him, and one of mine is as you know, my subject is hemp.
Yep.
Yeah, that was him that did that. That was him that smuggled it, and you know, it was him that started to grow it, and he said how it was better than a better crop than tobacco because it didn't deplete the soil and it didn't do all this other stuff and it had all these uses. And you know, I really do think he's in his grave, his little skeleton's just pulling a rotisserie because we really are not anywhere near where he, I think, his grand experiment envisioned us to be. And that's the real sad aspect of it. You were right, you know, when you said, you know, I started laughing and I didn't want to laugh because I want to be serious, but even though laughter is a good, you know me, I can laugh and have a serious time at the same time.
Sure.
You know, you say that we're going to see his face on a Walmart flyer. I mean, that's like a Bill Hicks joke. And it's, you know, it's funny and tragic at the same time that, you know, this is where we are. You know, people, they, oh, yeah, that's our founding father. But they don't really even understand, like, you know, where he's at. And I said it on the chat, but, you know, I do think that we need to buy two of those books. You know, one for us now, and maybe once we're done reading it, you know, pass it on to the children or, you know, pass it on to our local representatives so they can, you know, reread something that they think that they know and they don't act.
Well, one of the questions I didn't get around to asking Mr. Peterson was what Mr. Jefferson would think of, and I mean, I think I know what the answer is, having read the book, what he would think of the idea of politicians who become multimillionaires by serving in public office. Because that's the thing, Albert. You know, Mr. Peterson thinks that Mr. Jefferson would still think it possible to reclaim the experiment. I don't know, but what he'd just run out into the backyard and start screaming and tearing at his hair. This is not what we meant. You know, take one look at Tom DeLay and just go, bop, it failed. The experiment failed the minute Tom DeLay was born.
Yeah, and then it was had a couple of nails put in it with what's his name, Santorum.
Yeah, Santorum.
All of them.
Sure, Jack Abramoff, George Bush. You know the line in there about rogues that he quoted. I'd seen before, and he said, you know, the rogues will always rise. You know, there are a lot of rogues. But they can be managed if other people are interested in maintaining the integrity of their government. So there's an account of an indictment in there somewhere, isn't there, Albert? To the extent that
is not the existence of the Bush family an indictment of the American people? They stole the election. We know they stole the election. But way back when, they could have been stopped by an interested electorate. The people of Texas could have stopped that dumb little punk.
I hate to get all conspiratorial, but you know, it's like almost a grand scheme that you know, like they took the experiment, they took the parameters of it, and they just kind of operate outside the bounds of it. I mean, you know, like when we sit here and you look at how our lives are so much busier now, you know, and I'm not trying to make excuses, I'm just trying to state the reality. I mean, our lives are so much busier now. I mean, I wish that, you know, the people would even care so much, but, you know, by the time that, you know, some people work two jobs and some people have to work double shifts and some people, you know, and they don't have time to even care anymore. They just worry about what their day-to-day existence is, what's on television, how much it costs to fill my gas tank, and, you know, oh, look, there's...
Can you blame them for that?
No, and that's why, you know, and we look at these leaders. You know, like, as one of the things, you know, Jefferson wasn't a royalty, you know, even though he was an intellect and, you know, a royalty of the spirit kind of guy. But he wasn't, like, you know, a lineage royalty, you know, where, you know, we live in a plutocracy, which is, you know, direct descendant of aristocracy. I mean...
No, it's that marriage that he warned against, Albert.
Yeah.
It's kings, priests, and nobles. And the one place that I didn't get a chance to go with Mr. Peterson... is to point to a period in history that was on the rise at the time Jefferson died, and that is what is called, talk about the ultimate perversion of terms. At the time that the founders wrote the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution, we were in the Age of Reason, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Not too long after that, and like I said, it was on the rise by the time Jefferson and Adams died, you had what was called in history texts, the Great Awakening. Familiar with it?
Yeah, vaguely.
This is when the dirt ignorant, dumber than a box of rocks, circuit riding preachers, evangelists, and so forth, had their first great rise to prominence in this country, and that is when you see the beginning of the end of the Jeffersonian dream. It is the rise of the meeting on the ground, Sunday fried chicken eating circuit rider crowd that takes everything that Jefferson hoped for about the nature of the human spirit and spits on it and says, "No, God's mad at you. Go kill some Injuns and have you some slaves in the name of Jesus. Amen." And the historians, I don't know who coined the term, Albert, but he should be taken outside and just flogged for calling that an awakening. It is the great nightmare of the American experience when religion rose up on its filthy legs and destroyed Mr. Jefferson's dream. Sorry.
Amen. Amen.
Oh, wait, after something like that, we gotta have a little interlude, Albert. Hold on.
And I'm proud to be an American, where at least I know I'm free. And I won't forget the men who died, who gave that life to me. And I gladly stand up next to you.
And fill up my SUV.
Why did you do that to me?
Oh, only because I love you, man.
Oh, you need to go to Guantanamo.
Well, you know, those poor dudes have to get up and sing that every morning.
Oh, no.
Only they have to say Allah instead of God.
Well, you know, you gotta perform for the crowd, I guess.
And I'm proud to be a political prisoner of the great USA.
Because that's what happens with that song. It gets stuck in your head, and it because it's such an odd shape, it doesn't leave your ear. Other ear, it goes in one.
No, it's right out of Star Trek. Yeah, Captain, it was terrible. They put things in our ears.
those little sand ant lions that.
Yeah.
that's shudderingly.
Oh, I'm sorry. I just had to do that to you. But so much stuff I missed today. Did you notice that when it came time for Judge Walton to announce his decision on whether to tell Scooter Libby to go and get his toothbrush, Did you notice that he mentioned he has had death threats?
Yeah. Oh, I read that last night. Yeah, and that is also another hideously disgusting. You know what is and who is giving him death threats? Earth First.
That would be no.
Old Star Moms.
Sorry, no. It ain't Cindy Sheehan. It's not After Downing Street. It's not the crowd at Democratic Underground or your average horn listener.
Nope.
It's not the Malloy listener base.
Nope.
No, it's the Freepers.
And didn't we have just, I mean, wasn't it shortly after 9/11 where we actually had a couple of judges in Chicago that got killed? Didn't they get killed? Like we lost like six judges in a year.
Yeah, and then John Cornyn, senator from Texas, Republican maniac, stood up and said, well, I ain't advocating killing judges, but I sure do understand why you'd want to.
Yeah, he did, didn't he?
Yes, he did. And he's still walking free.
Man, we need a zeitgeist. I mean, we need a hardcore. That, instead of television at night, it's just got to be the zeitgeist. Just to remind. I mean, there's so much. It's obscene. And there's so much of it out there. That, I mean, it's like, well, today's obscenity over Trump's today. I mean, I am one that I believe I have a pretty long memory. And you know how they say that the American memory, they were talking about the American attention span back in the 70s being like 6 months. It ain't even 6 months now.
It's it's not as long as the news cycle. I mean, okay, let's have a little let's have a little pop culture moment here, Albert. What do you say?
I'll try. I've tried to wipe that just like that song. I try to wipe it out of my head.
Okay, so the blonde chick is basically serving penance in a California jail. She got moved from the hospital to the medical ward at the whatever. I don't care. Okay, and she's in there for 45 days because she busted her parole because the underlying offense was that she had driven drunk, just like George Bush.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
His wife.
All right, well, check out, check out this. Blank was arrested and thrown behind bars yesterday after cops say he used a brick. Now, this is after the little hissy I had on air last night about the guy getting beat to death in L.A. with a ball bat and the woman who was left to vomit blood and choke to death and die in misery on the floor of an ER in L.A. And okay. Blank was arrested and thrown behind bars yesterday after cops say he used a brick to beat the crap out of a man and his wife in the Hollywood Hills nearly 2 months ago. 26-year-old Blank, star of Blank, spent nearly an hour, oh my God, an hour, locked up in a Hollywood police station where he was charged with four felonies, including two counts of assault with a deadly weapon, one count of vandalism, and one count of throwing a substance at a vehicle. He was released. He was released, Albert, released on $60,000 bail. This would be the son, the 26-year-old son of Rod Stewart. If you want to enjoy, if you want to really get the fullness of the story, you need to go to TMZ.com and check his picture. He's like given like, you know, the Richie Blackmore, like, you know, Satan sign, like with the two fingers, you know?
Oh, the Bush sign that he always gives.
You know, the little hook 'em horns thing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And he's got like, he's just like tons of eye makeup on.
Nice. And he beat somebody to death? Is that what you...
He beat the crap out of them. A man and his wife with a brick.
And he's Rod Stewart's son, who's a millionaire music performer, right? Right?
Mm-hmm.
So what is $60,000 to these people? That's nothing.
Right. But he's not in jail.
I don't know. Bob, I don't know. It almost feels like if you, it's like you know who Aaron Russo is, right?
Mm-hmm.
Documentary. He was talking about his friendship for a while with Nelson or Nick Rockefeller, and he asked Aaron if he wanted to, because you know it's kind of funny. Angelina Jolie just joined the Council on Foreign Relations, and they asked Aaron if he wanted to, and he's like, "Well, what do I get out of it?" And he's like, "Well, you know, you basically get a card that says KNA on it, and you know what KNA means."
No.
It's my ass. The cops own this, and they leave you alone. And, you know, it's like, yeah, I know that they're doing this. And in a sense, almost they're like, I mean, the Paris Hilton deal where, you know, she could blubber and they're sent to the hospital and all that other nonsense. You know, like, Yeah, I'm sure she has a card, but, you know, like, they gotta, sometimes they gotta make an example out of her, and, you know, they didn't do anything that bad. But, you know, this guy sits there and assaults someone with a brick, then whatever else he does, and I mean, and then he's out on $60,000 bail? I mean...
Oh, by the way, totally separate, but by the way, Barack Obama's general counsel, or a guy named General Counsel Robert F. Bauer, he is hollering for Bush to pardon Scooter Libby.
I told you Obama was I told you.
It's wrestling.
Yeah, it totally is. It's disgusting. What? Pardon this guy? No.
I know.
I know. I can't. I'm sorry. I wish I would be a little more eloquent. I can't. It's just
there are points at which eloquence is not called for, Albert.
The schizo trigger just flips. It's just like, what? What? Wait. Whose side are you on? Whose side are you on? I mean, what are you selling out for? Even I'm sure it wasn't even Carvel talking about it. Didn't Carvel write a letter? Carvel and Matlin, you know, they're the little...
Well, dig his words, okay?
Oh.
Yeah, Carvel and Matlin, yeah, they did. They wrote a letter. I read it on the air about how their daughters just couldn't understand how sweet Mr. Scooter could possibly be out there trying to out a secret agent and get her killed. Because he's nice. He's Mr. Scooter. This is what Robert F. Bauer wrote. To Bush's antagonists on the left, a pardon would be only another act in the conspiracy, a further cover-up, a way of getting away with it. But this is the entirely wrong way of seeing things. A pardon is just what Bush's opponents should want.
Just like we should
100 proof or 80, Albert?
That's 180. That's just like we should want. Oh yeah. We know Iraq's not gonna do any good. So what we'll do is we'll give him enough rope to hang himself, right? Yeah. We'll give him a blank check. We'll give him $24 billion more than he asked for Iraq, and then we'll lose another 700 U.S. troops and 10,000 more Iraqi civilians and all this other junk nonsense. That's, you know, like, who are these people? Where do these people come from thinking like this? Seriously, Bob, I don't understand this. I don't understand this. It makes no sense. It's like, are they trying to be strategic? I'd love to play Risk with these people. I'd love it.
Yeah, as long as I get Australia to start.
Exactly. But I'm just saying, I can barely breathe. It's just obscene. It's totally obscene. That's my word for the day. It's obscene. And it's disgusting. And, you know, I wish they would listen to us. And it's like, it's obvious that they don't. It's just obvious. They have nothing but contempt for us. They have nothing but they just want to sit there and, you know, yeah, we'll tell you what you want to hear. We'll talk to you in a twang when we're sitting in front of a crowd. And I can talk to you in a twang. And then when I talk to another, I'll talk like this. And then I'll, you know, they're just disgusting people. I don't understand how anybody could sit there and go, oh, I like him. Oh, wait. Yeah, I can, because nobody has time to pay attention to this stuff, Bob. That's the problem. We have no time for this. Everybody's got to work two jobs and do this and do that. And, you know, you're working man radio. I mean, you know, look at this. You guys are raising a family. You're doing all this stuff. And, I mean, you got to pull a little shift switch and, you know, go pick up a kid from football and do all this stuff. I mean, like, that is honorable. You need to run for office. We need Bob Kincaid's in office.
Oh, that's a good one.
We need you. We need everybody in the chat.
No, we do need. We need committed people, and we need them out there running in primaries. We need them to tighten up the money crowd. We need them in. Not me. I have feet of clay. Mine are softer than most. I've got feet of Play-Doh. We need people running. And I don't care if they run as Democrats or Greens here in West Virginia. Run on the Mountain Party ticket. Win a few elections. Run for county commission. Run for school board. Run for your. You want to be a Democrat? Run for your local Democratic Executive Committee.
Let's think like a Republican scum for a second. Let's go do like what they do and run as them.
Yeah. You know, I have, in my darker, more inebriated moments, Albert, I have thought about registering as a Republican in this state.
Yeah,
just to get to the meetings and watch their hair stand on end when I say something like, "Who gives a damn what a woman does with her body?"
Ooh,
it ain't my business. When I grow a uterus, I'll care.
Yeah, exactly. You know, why don't you just leave it to the private sector, you know, or something like that.
Isn't it charming?
It's just amazing. It's mind-blowingly amazing. And they don't even care. I mean, yeah, come on, like Brock, they don't care. They got their KMA cards, baby. They don't care about this stuff. You know, come on. You know, they'll sit there and they'll just keep playing it.
Oh, I know. I still haven't done my Amtrak story. I hope to get to that maybe tomorrow night. But you know, I think about it, and I know why nothing's happening to improve passenger rail in this country, because none of the power elite with their KMA cards ever have to ride it.
You know what? Amen. I just sent my mom. My mom just went back to Idaho where she lives, and she's got some land out there, and she just was up here to visit and you know, see the grandchildren and babies and stuff, and you know, we just sent her back, and you know, that's exactly what I noticed. You know, I sat there and I drove up here into the train station, and I'm like, you know, everybody here, you know, honestly, it would be my preference to ride on the train, just because I don't feel like having a cavity search, just sit and coach.
Yeah.
Which is torture on itself. I've flown around the world like three times.
I'm 6 feet two. It is a misery to ride on an airplane.
Oh, yeah. And so, but I would choose to do that. But at the same time, a lot of people don't have that choice. And then they look at the buses. I mean, that's another thing.
I saw America on this train. I met America on this train. And we were all walking around with compressed spines because the suspension on the cars was so badly in need of repair that the entire car would bottom out against the axle every time we crossed went over a crossing.
Well, my mom broke down for 3 hours. She was outside of, and she even said, she's like, oh, look, oh, good, it's a brand new car. I hate those old cars, you know, because she rides the train when she comes out here.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, she exactly what she said.
You mean there's a train that goes from Wisconsin to Idaho?
Oh, yeah, it goes all the way from Chicago all the way to Seattle.
Oh, that's the Empire Builder.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
See,
yeah.
I'm a train geek.
Yeah, I love train. This country, I mean, you know, I know you're going to agree with this, so I'm just going to say it. We need a high-speed rail.
Oh, so bad.
I mean, we need, that's what they have in Europe. They've had these high-speed rails, and, you know, it's actually faster to fly, to go on the high-speed train than it is to ride on a plane.
Oh, by the time you've stood there and had your baggage lost and everything, absolutely.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
Boom, 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 you're there. And that's what this country needs. This country needs that. I mean, granted, I mean, they have to build a whole new track. Well, what does that do, Bob?
No. The right-of-way is already there. I passed them, okay? There's a set of rails eastbound, set of rails westbound, and a whole bunch of right-of-way and abandoned rail all along. I saw it. It exists. But
I think they'd have to refit it just for...
Oh, sure. You couldn't use the rails, but the right-of-ways exist.
Okay.
Yeah, absolutely. Hey, Albert, we got to knock it off, brother.
All right, Bob, I'll talk to you later.
All right, see ya. Bye now. God, I love doing this. What a wonderful evening you all have provided me with, and I thank you so sincerely. Agnes, with her usual lovely job of answering the phones and running the program. John, our engineer in Sydney. How many people do you know who can engineer a radio studio in West Virginia all the way from Sydney, Australia? You see what goes into this? And, of course, Ben Birch. Ben Birch, the hardest working man in liberal talk. I say repeal the congressional ban on cloning. We need about 100 more Bens and money to support them. WhiteRoseSociety.org. And, of course, our IT consultant, Peter Godbold, soon to be the host of the most fabulous homosexual agenda conversation radio show on the planet, Strictly Confidential, coming at 9 p.m. Eastern, Monday, June 18th. I don't care if it's not dark yet, Liza. Go to sleep. And always, 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 RMR, Gina. It's all for you.
We'll be right back. You're listening to The Horn, the head-on radio network.
The Quality News Network. In the Gaza Strip, Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas has declared a state of emergency and dissolved the unity government. Hamas pushed out of its Fatah rivals and has taken control of the area. Witnesses say after overrunning two enemy security command centers, Hamas fighters dragged rivals out of a building and shot them execution style in the street. Hamas has declared the Gaza Strip is now under Islamic rule and will become an Islamic state. South of Baghdad, three Sunni mosques were torched in retaliation for yesterday's bombing of the minarets of a revered Shiite shrine, the Golden Mosque in Samarra, 65 miles north of the capital. A curfew has been imposed in the region and vehicles have been cleared from Baghdad's streets. The heavily fortified Green Zone was bombarded with rockets and mortars. One of them came close to Iraq's parliament building. U.S. Ambassador to Iraq, Ryan Crocker, placed the attack of the Golden Mosque on the Al-Qaeda. The transfer of $25 million worth of North Korean dollars that were frozen began today from Macau to Pyongyang. North Korea was using the money as a bargaining chip in exchange for nuclear disarmament. NATO ministers met today in Brussels to discuss how to avoid civilian casualties in Afghanistan and U.S. claims that Iran is arming the Taliban. Also on the table, America's proposed placement in Europe of a missile defense shield. President Bush has made a concession to help move the immigration bill along. He has agreed to funding for federal border security up front to gain the support of conservatives. A judge has ruled that former White House aide Louis Scooter Libby must go to prison while he appeals his